Maybe home is somewhere I'm going. Written by Astolat. Read by Quiet Night. They were about 50 miles from Atlanta when Sam stirred and yawned awake in the passenger seat. Morning, Steve said. The sun had come up, but the two-lane road was still pretty empty, a little morning mist hanging low over the asphalt and in the trees. Sam squinted out the window at a passing sign.
We're near Canton? Since when did we head south?
Since I got a call from Natasha about 4 hours ago, Steve said. Reliable sighting of a man with a steel hand in southwest Atlanta. He broke up a fight in a bar parking lot, beat up some of the guys on one side, put a couple of them in the hospital. He made himself say it calmly, easily. He wasn't going to believe it just yet. Most of the witnesses had probably been drunk, but, in his gut, he couldn't help hoping. It was Bucky all over, wading into a fight that wasn't his, maybe because he saw some little guy getting his ass kicked. The news was 4 days old, but that was a 10-year improvement on the next freshest lead they'd found so far. Sounded worth following up. He jerked his chin at a billboard for a roadside joint a few miles away, saying, "People say we haven't kept up with the times, but we're open 24 hours a day. Want to stop for some coffee?" Sam shook his head, yawning and twisting side to side in the seat to loosen up. "Nah, keep going. We're going to have to stop anyway, closer to the city. I should have warned you about Atlanta."
"What?"
Steve said, shooting Sam a look.
"You think there's some kind of Hydra base here?"
"No, dude, my grandmother's here," Sam said. "We'll get breakfast at her place."
"She won't mind us just showing up,"
Steve said. Sam snorted.
"We don't show up, my life will not be worth living."
"Oh,"
when Steve laughed.
"You think that's funny? I'll be hearing about it for the next 5 years. Please pass the grits, Grandma, at Thanksgiving, and I'll get—"
"You sure? I figured you didn't like him that much, seeing as how you couldn't be bothered to stop in and get some."
"How would she know if you don't tell her?" Steve said, but he was grinning. He'd known guys with family like that. If you got a furlough and didn't come home, you'd better have been bleeding in a ditch somewhere.
"Remember that guy who tweeted that photo of us from Boston last week?"
Sam said.
"It showed up on her Facebook 15 minutes after it went up. No way am I taking a chance like that. I have cautionary tales. My cousin Mark, he went to Cancun instead of coming to family Christmas 3 years ago, and he hasn't had a piece of my grandma's pecan pie since. She doesn't bring it out until he's in another room and there are enough mouths around that it's all gone before he gets any. My people know how to make you regret your misdeeds."
"Okay, then,"
Steve said, smiling.
"Breakfast at your grandmother's place."
The house was out in the suburbs of the city, in a quiet neighborhood, on a quiet street. Steve climbed out of the car and looked around, feeling oddly out of place and comfortable at the same time. The house looked big to his eyes, but he was pretty sure that that was a city kid in him. It wasn't fancy or anything, just a nice place, a lot like the houses on either side, with grass and trees and a simple front yard. Ordinary, in a good way, a place that was about family. There didn't seem to be a lot of families around his place in D.C. Sometimes you saw strollers with little kids in them being pushed on the street, or college kids, but not much in between. Playgrounds, but no kids running around loose in the street playing stickball and yelling. He hadn't noticed before how it made things feel wrong. Here, maybe there weren't any kids running around outside right this minute, but you could still feel their presence. A football lying half buried in the grass, a couple of toys on the front step. Sam was ringing the bell, and there was a commotion from inside the house, 4 women across a range of ages coming out to hug him, and he could hear kids' voices raised. "Uncle Sam! Uncle Sam!" a bunch of them yelling at once. And when Sam turned around again, a big-eyed 2-year-old girl with tight braids had gotten attached to his neck.
"Hey, man, come on up here. Grandma, I brought my friend Steve for breakfast."
They ate with 8 people, all told. Sam's grandmother, Ruth, his Aunt Lena, who lived with her, and Lena's daughters both visiting with their kids for the weekend. Breakfast was eggs, 2 kinds of ham, bacon, home fries, biscuits, gravy.
"Would you boys eat some chicken fried steak? Maybe I'll make some."
And both of them saying they were full, which didn't stop the steak from appearing about 15 minutes later. Hotcakes and coffee, and the cheese grits, which were more than good enough to be worth a visit. More kept getting dished out. Steve ate for about an hour straight, and finally had to give up with food still on his plate, the first time since the serum that that had ever happened. Sam was already sprawled back in his chair, refusing fourths.
"Well, if you're sure you don't want any more,"
Sam's grandma said, with a faint suggestion in her voice that she was deeply disappointed in them,
"I guess you can clear up."
Sam groaned faintly, and then heaved himself up. Steve helped carry dishes to the kitchen. They washed the dishes in the sink, a big window looking out over the backyard. The kids were out there running around the swing set, playing some kind of game. After a few minutes watching, Steve realized the game was blowing up the helicarriers. The oldest one was flying around with his arms spread, and the 5-year-old girl was jumping around with a round plastic lid on her arm. They finished the dishes and got shooed out to the back.
"Go on. I'll put up another pot of coffee,"
his Aunt Lena said. Sam glanced a question at him. Steve had pulled into the driveway, hoping to get back on the road as soon as they could without being rude, but somehow now the words didn't want to come to his mouth. Instead, he followed Sam out and sat on the deck, cool green shade trees blocking the sun, the kids running around and playing. The coffee came out, along with pie. Sam's aunt rubbed Sam's shoulder with a hand in passing as she went back inside, just a small loving gesture. His grandma was in a rocking chair with knitting, and an iPad on the table next to her, that made a new email ping every 10 minutes or so.
"I hear you grew up in New York City, Steve," Ruth said, without looking up from her knitting, exactly as if she weren't talking about something that had happened a century ago. "We got people up there ourselves. One of my sons and Sam's mother. You from Brooklyn?"
"Yes, ma'am," Steve said, and answered questions about his family, his church, his old neighborhood, and his new one. The questions about church made him feel vaguely guilty. It had been a long time. But he tried, and he hadn't felt comfortable. The church had been a lot fancier than his old one back in Brooklyn, and there had been a lot of people in expensive clothes staring at him in the aisles. Afterwards, the priest wanted to talk to him in his office, which made Steve feel at first like he'd done something horribly wrong, and then just weird. The guy mainly had seemed interested in getting a picture of him in uniform in the church, and having him promote some kind of group trying to get politicians to make abortions illegal again. It hadn't felt good. It hadn't felt anything like talking to old Father Mac, who'd picked Steve up out of alleys once in a while and taken him back to the church to clean him up. This guy, with his big fancy polished wood desk and expensive suit, sure wasn't setting foot in any alleyways. And as for the abortion thing, Steve asked Peggy about it and got about 5 earfuls about girls dying on coat hangers and men minding their own damn business. So that was that. He hadn't gone back. But this did feel good. Even the squirm at being asked about church was familiar, and he didn't mind it. He didn't mind any of it, even though Sam tried to fend off some of the questions for him.
"Sorry, man. I didn't know I was bringing you in for the third degree here," Sam said, glaring at his grandma indignantly. She didn't bat an eye.
"An old lady's got a right to be nosy," she said firmly. "So your ma's folks are from Ireland? I think one of Sam's cousins on his dad's side married a girl whose father was from Ireland. Isn't that right, honey? Your cousin Polly?"
"I have 19 cousins, damn if I know," Sam said, laughing.
Ruth was nodding to herself.
"No, that was it. I remember. I talked to her grandmother at the wedding. She came over for it. From Kilkenny, that was it. Nice folks. It was a nice wedding. Whereabouts were your people from?"
Steve excused himself after a bit to go to the bathroom, and while he was there, he abruptly bent down and washed his face with cold water, feeling hot and tired and sad, or more like noticing that he was hot and tired and sad, because it was the first time in a long while he'd felt anything else. He laced his cold, wet hands on the back of his neck and breathed in and out a few times, and then he wiped his face and went back outside. Sam's aunt was standing with a hand resting on Ruth's chair, her face a little drawn and worried. Sam was saying, "Do the same for me if it was Riley out there," flat and a little bit angry, and he cut it off when Steve came out the door.
"We should probably get going," he said, standing up.
"Be careful driving," his grandmother said equably, lifting her head so Sam could kiss her cheek. His aunt didn't say anything, just hugged him tight one last time.
"Sorry about that,"
Sam said, in the car. He'd taken the wheel. Steve stared out the window at houses rolling by. Ordinary lives. More swing sets. More kids. People sitting on their front porches. American flags waving here and there.
Don't be, he said, his throat tight. You've got people who worry about you. Don't be sorry.
He felt Sam's eyes on him. He didn't look back to meet them. After a minute, Sam patted his thigh, and then kept on driving. They found the bar. It was only about 15 minutes' drive away. The bartender had seen a bunch of the fight. Steve showed him the sketches he'd made, pictures drawn in the front seat of the car over the last few weeks. Bucky's face, or what his face had become, hollows under two wide eyes, a mouth set permanently down, long, stringy hair, and the arm, the hand, all the silver, gleaming parts of it.
Yeah, the bartender said immediately, positive. Yeah, that was it,
pointing at the drawing of the hand.
I know, 'cause I was going to tell him no brass knuckles, and then I got close and figured it was a prosthetic, so I backed off. And then outside I saw him put it through the freaking hood of a car.
He let them watch the tapes from the parking lot security camera, blurry footage of a guy with dark hair, moving faster than the cheap camera could follow, going through a group of people who seemed to be standing still to be hit.
Hey,
Sam said, nudging him, and Steve looked up from the black-and-white screen to follow where he was looking, through the front window of the place and across the street, at a cheap motel with a lit-up vacancy sign. They caught a break. Bucky had paid in cash for 2 weeks in advance and left the Do Not Disturb sign on the door. The room hadn't been cleaned up yet. The mirror in the bathroom had been smashed in, cracks spiderwebbed out from an impact the size of a fist. The garbage can was overflowing with trash. Steve couldn't help the first surge of excitement, hope. Then they spent hours piecing together garbage, crumpled newspapers, fast food wrappers, packaging for a mini USB cable, receipt for a power screwdriver. Nothing that pointed anywhere. The newspapers were all recent, and Bucky was long gone. Steve sat down on one of the beds, heavily. They were both still made. Bucky had probably slept on the floor. He put his face in his hands. After a moment, he felt the bed shift as Sam sat down next to him, put a hand on his shoulder.
He's got to know I'm looking for him,
Steve said. He could barely hear his own voice.
Why wouldn't he?
He stopped. He'd read the file. He knew the reasons, all the reasons it could be. He just didn't want to believe them. Steve looked around the room, dark, faded walls, cheap bedspread made out of something that felt weird and unnatural, almost waterproof.
Why would he come here, sit in a motel room, start a bar fight, take off again? Hey, hang on a second,
Sam said. He was smoothing out the hardware store receipt, but it was just a small ticker tape receipt, useless. Even the top where the store name might have been listed was obliterated, where mustard had smeared across it and disintegrated the paper.
Look at this, man. There wasn't any change given, and it's $65.93. I'll bet you he paid for this with a credit card. It doesn't have the number,
Steve said, tiredly.
No, but the store would have it,
Sam said. He looked at his watch and shook his head.
Too late now, and around here the store's mostly closed on Sunday. On Monday we can call around the neighborhood, try and find the place. Might take us a while, but chances are we'll find it. If we get Natasha that number, maybe she can dig something else up for us.
Sam drove them back to his grandma's place and ordered Steve out to the backyard to play with the kids. The oldest boy, Caleb, studied him with a skeptical expression. He was clearly in charge.
Okay, you can be the helicarrier,
he finally allowed, and Steve spent the next 2 solid hours being crashed by one elaborate scheme after another, including the one where Caleb was a dinosaur, Miriam was someone named Elsa who had ice powers that Steve made a mental note to find out about, Jeb was Spider-Man, and little Jerusha was a pony, who dealt the final crushing blow with a stick she picked up and declared was a magic wand. That led to a long yelling argument over whether ponies could use magic wands, with Miriam insisting that magic ponies could, and Caleb insisting that ponies didn't have hands, even if they were magical. They finally compromised on a complete do-over.
Maybe we could play hide-and-seek instead,
Steve tried.
A helicarrier can't hide. It is way too big,
Miriam said firmly.
Death to Hydra!
The kids all yelled and jumped on him at the same time. After another hour, Steve called a halt.
Okay, that's it, he said, flattened out on the grass. I'm down. I'm in the Potomac. Done.
The kids all sighed noisily. Caleb nudged him in the side with the inflatable bat he'd been using. He was being Thor this time around.
"Maybe you have one engine left?" he said hopefully.
"Nope,"
Steve said, refusing to open his eyes.
"It's on fire." "Okay, you guys, lay off the old man," Sam's voice said. "Time to go wash up. Dinner's in 10.
A chorus of awes and a half-hearted wail from Jerusha, and they marched off. Steve opened his eyes as Sam settled down in the grass next to him, grinning.
"Captain America brought down at last." "I've been on forced marches that took less energy," Steve said ruefully, propping himself on an elbow. But he was smiling up at Sam, and it wasn't an effort. "I better warn you, you might be getting volunteered for a trip to the zoo tomorrow," Sam said. "After church, which you can bag on account of being a Catholic heathen, if you want."
"No," Steve said. "No, I'll come, if that's okay."
"Tell my grandma you're coming, and maybe she'll even lay off you after dinner," Sam said.
She didn't lay off after dinner. It wasn't a fair fight. Steve could barely move. There had been 4 courses and 3 kinds of pie.
"Well, we thought you boys would maybe be back," she'd said, "so we made a little extra just in case. Here, you haven't even tasted the peach pie. Take it with some ice cream."
And afterwards, Steve collapsed next to Sam in the porch rocker and gave up everything. Details about his family he hadn't even known that he knew, a description of his old apartment back before the war, and the block after that, the kids he'd used to run with, 70 years ago, 3 years ago for him. He could almost see their faces in front of his eyes, a game of stickball, Bucky looking around to grin at him. Then Ruth paused and said,
"Any of your people from back then still around?"
And Bucky's face changed, hair lengthening, hollows shattered in his cheeks, murder in his eyes. Steve flinched hard.
"Excuse me a moment," he said, and got himself upstairs and shut himself into the bathroom again. It was a nice bathroom, dark blue tile and white paint, fresh, clean lines.
Steve opened the window for some fresh air and braced himself against the sill, half hearing Sam snapping at his grandma below. Steve was sorry. He didn't want to put Sam in that position. It wasn't even like he hadn't been asked questions before. It just hit harder here, somehow, to remember that he didn't have any of this. A place to belong. People who were his.
"Bring my friend here, and you're going after him like a tabloid," Sam was saying, really angry. And even though Steve felt bad about it, he shut his eyes and let himself feel grateful anyway, for my friend.
For one person Steve could halfway feel like was his, even if he didn't have a right to him.
Then Ruth said, "Samuel Thomas Wilson,"
low and sharp, cutting Sam off.
"I'm not asking him questions because he's Captain America, and you know it."
Sam didn't answer her, abruptly gone silent. Steve lifted his head, puzzled, and then realized he was eavesdropping. He put his hands on the window, and then he didn't shut it after all, because she was going on.
"You think I don't know what it means when you bring a friend to this house with that look in your eye?"
And Sam still wasn't saying anything.
"I've had 4 children and 7 grandchildren married before you, so don't talk to me like I got no business asking that young man questions."
And Sam still didn't say anything. Sam didn't tell her she was wrong. And then Sam finally said, quietly,
"Grandma, you need to back off. It's not like that, all right? I'm not putting anything on him right now. He's in a pretty dark place."
She snorted.
"What do you think marriage is even for? I suppose you think raising a family's nothing but good times, year in and year out."
Sam groaned, a muffled sound, like he'd put his hands over his face.
"I should have taken my chances with Twitter,"
he said, still muffled. Steve made himself shut the window, slow and quiet. It was too late, though. He spent most of the night awake, staring at the ceiling, thinking about it. About Sam, breathing steadily in the twin bed on the other side of the room, so close. He could get up and go to him, right now, kneel next to Sam's bed and put a hand on his arm, and Sam would wake up and look at him, and then Sam would let him in. Steve pressed his palms to his eyes, helplessly imagining Sam's hands skimming up his shirt over his skin, Sam murmuring low, "I've got you," squeezing into a bed that was already too small for either one of them, Sam's arms around him, holding him on, and knowing the whole time that it meant something, that he was asking a question, getting an answer. He'd thought about Sam the other that way before. Hell, the first time he'd passed him going around the mall. But he had plenty of practice with that stuff, with guys and girls both. In his book, a decent guy kept that stuff to himself. Sure, he'd needed a few moments of privacy now and then, 3 months on the road together, Sam coming out of the shower naked, a last drop of water rolling down between his shoulder blades as he bent over the suitcase to get out fresh clothes. Sam laughing full out in the car, an arm stretched out behind Steve in the driver's seat, highway sunshine glowing warm on his skin through the windshield, feeling Sam's eyes pausing on him, warm and just a little heavy-lidded when Steve was pulling off his shirt at night. But that wasn't the same thing as asking somebody for a dance, for a date, for their hand in marriage. Not that Steve had ever figured out how to do any of those things. He'd privately been hoping, back when, that Peggy would let him know when it was time to propose. But still, that was how things were supposed to go, as far as he was concerned. He didn't like how they seemed to work these days, where people dated for years sometimes, having sex and even a good time, but not really getting anywhere, not putting their cards on the table, saying they were all in, ready to be part of something bigger. And even when they did go all in, they left themselves an out. That wasn't anything he wanted. This, though, Christ, did he want this? Steve didn't care who'd make fun of him for thinking marriage before he'd even gotten a kiss. What the hell had waiting ever gotten him? He knew how Sam took his coffee, the quiet sound he made right when he was falling asleep, that he used a suitcase instead of a duffel and kept it packed in a crisp, exact order so he could lay his hands on anything he needed under a count of five. He knew Sam would follow him into a firefight straight out of hell and die trying to catch him if he jumped off a plane. He knew Sam would go all in when he went, and now he knew Sam would go for him. Except it would be selfish as hell to ask now. Sam could go all in, but he couldn't. Because Bucky was out there, alone. So hurt it made Steve sick if he thought about it too hard. Steve had no idea what it was going to mean when they finally tracked Bucky down. There was room in that grotesque file for a whole lot of worst-case scenarios, spending the rest of his own life trying to help Bucky put together the jigsaw pieces of his, with not a lot of him left over for anything, for anybody else. But whatever it took, he was still on the hook for it. There wasn't a choice about that, not one Steve could make. He knew Sam got that. Sam, who still had Riley's half-melted dog tags, the ones he'd dived through fire to bring home. That didn't mean Sam was going to be in the market for whatever leavings Steve had to give, or that it was fair to try and sell them to him. Steve hadn't blamed Ruth for asking questions to begin with. Now he got it completely. What else was she supposed to do? What would she think, any of Sam's people think, about Sam getting himself tied up with a guy who was taking everything he had to give, giving nothing back? No odds of that changing any time soon. Nobody who loved Sam would want that for him. So, that was the answer. Final and brutal. If Steve asked, he couldn't love Sam worth a damn. Steve turned over with his back to the room, to Sam's bed. He shut his eyes. It was hard to act normal in the morning and not let on about any of it. He felt like shit, but at least his super-soldier body kept ticking on, happy to eat more eggs and bacon and sling a couple of gleefully shrieking kids over his shoulders for the walk out to the cars. But he caught Sam's eyes on him a couple of times and did his best to avoid them. It wasn't like going to mass. The church was plain and simple, just a single big cross on the wall and a podium for a pulpit. But the singing was amazing, the whole room knowing all the words, clapping, moving with the music. Steve could have felt awkward and out of place, except Sam was right next to him, and Sam belonged here. Even the sermon was like music, full of rhythm, people shouting out, calling to join in. By then a murmur was going around the room. People had looked first just because he was one of maybe four white guys in the place, and then they'd started double-taking at him and Sam both. Steve squared his shoulders, ready to put up with it, but instead the pastor said from the head of the room, "All right, I know y'all can't help whispering. That's right, we got a couple of our country's heroes in the room today. Now let's all thank the Lord together that he brought 'em safe to the shore, and let's pray he keeps on bringing 'em in, and all their brothers and sisters in arms with 'em." The amens rang off the walls, and Steve felt his eyes stinging, painful and hot. Someone in the choir started singing again, spontaneous, and everyone picked it up. Full-throated praise. The storm is passing over. Steve couldn't see any more. The floor he was staring at a blur. But Sam put a hand on the small of his back, warm through his thin dress shirt, and it was like being grounded enough to take a lightning strike. But afterwards it only made things even worse. In the friendly milling around after the service, Sam stayed close, keeping a hand on him, connected. Steve wanted to step away, or wanted to be able to step away, knowing it was the right thing to do, but he couldn't bear to. He went through the motions, talked to people, shook hands, said thank you a lot, without really knowing what he was doing, only that he wasn't lonely, that he wasn't alone. Except he was. With everything, it took nearly an hour to get back to the parking lot after the service. Steve mechanically helped load up the kids, then got back into their car. Sam slid into the driver's seat and said quietly, "Tell me honestly, you up for the zoo? It's fine if not. They'll go without us." Steve stared out the windshield and said, "No." His throat felt thick. Sam just nodded, sent his aunt a text, then drove them straight back to the house. It felt strange and empty, just the two of them coming into it. Steve went straight through to the back without pausing and sat on the steps of the deck, half hunched over. Sam came out and sat down next to him. Their thighs were close together, shoulders brushing. Steve wanted to lean into him. He wanted to turn and bury his face in Sam's chest, wanted to drag Sam down into the soft grass of the lawn and put his hands all over Sam's body, stake a claim. He balled his fists up on his thighs to keep from touching, and Sam said, "Okay, hell no, come here." Took him by the shoulders to draw him up and kissed him. Steve kissed him back desperately. He felt guilty even while he did it, a thief taking something that didn't belong to him. His clenched hands were resting on Sam's chest, but Sam was holding on to him, murmuring softly between kisses, "I'm here, I got you." And Steve shuddered all over. His hands slid open, shaking, to wrap around Sam's body. Sam stroked his back. "Come on, we're going upstairs," he said, and stood to haul him to his feet. Steve stumbled after him to the stairs, giving in to his own selfishness, trying not to think. Sun was coming in through the window, the sheets warm on the narrow bed. Steve lay back and helped Sam strip him with shaking hands, spread his thighs and raised his hips for Sam's hands, panting and desperate. "You ready for this?" Sam said, softly, leaning over him, his whole face serious. "Please," Steve said, because the least he could do was ask, acknowledge the gift. "Please, Sam, oh God." And Sam was lifting Steve's hips up, hooking Steve's legs over his own thighs, and pushing into him. Sam was taking him. "Do you take this man?" Steve thought suddenly, dizzy and overwhelmed, and he gasped out once and just came, a shocking full-body climax that shook him all over, almost convulsive, then dropped him, limp, back against the pillows. He felt a little calmer after, easier. He could breathe again, and Sam was still in him, gently rocking in and out, waiting, strong hands rubbing Steve's thighs. Steve groaned and sat up in one heave, settling down on top of Sam to grind down on him, already turned on again. He bent down and kissed the gasp out of Sam's mouth. "Oh, there we go," Sam murmured, breathless, up into his mouth, warm and smiling, his hands secure on Steve's sides. And, God, there was no way Steve could say no to this. He couldn't imagine how he'd held out for, well, less than 24 hours, since he'd figured out he could maybe have it. But even that seemed completely improbable now. "I shouldn't let you," Steve said, resting his forehead against Sam's. "Sam, you deserve to choose what I want for myself," Sam said, calm and steady, stroking Steve's back. "Not that you can't show your appreciation." He gave Steve a good healthy thrust, meaningful, and Steve half laughed, gasped. But, okay, he had a mission objective now. He could handle that, and he braced himself on Sam's shoulders and started to slide and fall on him. They fucked for nearly 2 hours straight. At one point, they fell off the bed onto the floor and just kept going. Steve was drunk on it, on happiness. Another burst of joy every time Sam nuzzled him, ran possessive hands over his thighs and chest, murmured, "Man, I have no idea how I'm ever going to let you out of bed in the mornings." "So don't," Steve said dizzily, sprawled on his back on the floor with a leg flung over Sam's shoulder, getting fucked again. He loved it so much. Sam, a palpable presence on him, inside him, every stroke saying, "Yes, you're mine. Yes." Sam said, low and amused, and a little gravelly, "Maybe only on special occasions." "Works for me," Steve said. Finally, they had to give up. They couldn't be bothered squeezing into one of the tiny beds. They just lay sprawled out on the floor together, a sweaty mess, atop the bedclothes they'd pulled down with them. Sam was stroking Steve's back with his fingertips, gently gliding over. Steve lay his head against Sam's shoulder, breathing deeply, feeling a steady peace.
"So what flipped the switch for you?"
Sam said, his voice rumbling through his chest.
"Not that I'm complaining."
Steve winced guiltily.
Yesterday, I overheard you and your grandmother talking."
"Steve Rogers, you're an eavesdropper? I'm shocked,"
Sam said.
"How'd you even manage it? I didn't hear you."
"I opened the upstairs bathroom window," Steve admitted. Sam frowned up at the ceiling.
"That thing's been stuck shut since I was 9 years old,"
he said, then snorted.
"Yeah, look who I'm talking to."
"How did you know?"
"You give me that hello airman look through your lashes 10 times a day before breakfast. Suddenly you go cold turkey and look like you're fighting yourself not to touch every time I get in arm's reach. Let me tell you how much rocket science was involved in figuring that one out."
Steve groaned. "Sam," he said, and stopped. He couldn't apologize. He couldn't be sorry.
"I know you're in a tough place right now,"
Sam said.
"That's why I figured I wasn't going to start this now. But what I want from you is for better and worse. Right now it's worse for you. Someday it'll be worse for me. I told my folks you'd be on the road next to me if it was Riley out there lost as hell. Was I lying?"
"No," Steve managed, throat tight. Sam nodded.
"All right, then."
Like it was that simple. And Steve could just about believe that maybe it could be. He kissed Steve again.
"Come on, we'd better be getting cleaned up before they get back. There are some things a man's grandma doesn't want to know about."
They took turns in the shower and ran a fast load of laundry. The door started opening just after the dryer buzzer went off, and Steve grabbed the sheets and made it upstairs in a desperate rush. They got the beds made not quite to regulation spec, just as the pack of kids appeared in the door of the bedroom, all of them in face paint and loaded up with Mylar balloons.
"Why are you making your beds again?"
Miriam asked loudly, just as Lena showed up behind them, and Steve caught Sam glaring at him, but it wasn't his fault. He couldn't control the blushing.
"Hey, who wants to play helicarriers again?"
he said hurriedly, and took the fastest escape route. He had to pay for it with another 2 hours of Mortal Kombat, but it was worth it not to have to look any of the grown-ups in the face. Sam put his head out after a while and said,
"Hey, guys, I'm going to get pizza for dinner."
There were cheers and immediate cries for about 12 different kinds of toppings, until Sam held up a hand.
"One topping each, go,"
and pointed to each of the kids in turn, which yielded mushroom pepperoni sausage. And then Jerusha said, "Anchovies," and the others all groaned.
"You don't like them," Miriam said. "You just like saying anchovies."
"Anchovies," Jerusha said militantly.
"We'll get a slice with anchovies,"
Sam said, grinning, and looked at Steve.
"Broccoli," Steve said, which netted him 4 disgusted looks. "You know, you guys don't even know how good you've got it. When I grew up, you couldn't get green vegetables all year round."
The kids were all unimpressed.
"Yuck," Jeb said. "You can take it out on him till I get back," Sam said cheerfully.
"Thanks a lot,"
Steve yelled as they all attacked his legs and toppled him over. Sam just waved a jaunty goodbye at him, going. A few minutes later, he got rescued, unwillingly. Ruth appeared at the back porch and ordered the kids inside to wash up before dinner, and ordered him to sit down and keep an old lady company. She settled herself in her chair with her knitting. Steve nervously took another one and tried to think of a conversation topic that wouldn't lead him into danger. He didn't have time. She said,
"You met Sam's ma already, I know."
"A month ago," Steve said. There had been a few reported sightings in New York, but they'd all come to nothing. Unreliable witnesses, glimpses based on the missing person sketch of Bucky's face that Steve had given to police to post. The locations hadn't even been in Brooklyn. They'd stopped by Sam's mom's place to say hello on their way out of town, but Steve hadn't been much for company. The city had been his private, secret hope all along, the chance that there was enough left in Bucky's head to draw him home, and with three different sighting reports in his pocket, Steve had stepped off the L, half hoping to see Bucky standing there, waiting for him, in the shadows under the tracks. But there hadn't been any sign of him anywhere, and nobody in the old neighborhood had seen a man with a silver hand. It had hurt to lose that last lingering hope, to have to face the odds that whatever misfire had stopped the Winter Soldier from killing him had been just that, a temporary blink in a program that Hydra had written over the man underneath. Steve had spent that night sitting on the floor between the motel beds, crying, mourning Bucky all over again, trying to dull the pain with three bottles of whiskey and Sam's arm around his shoulders. The whiskey hadn't helped. Sam had. Steve looked down at his hands.
"I know," he said haltingly, because Sam's family deserved it from him. "I know I'm not who any of you would have picked for him."
"A white Catholic boy from 1918?
Ruth said dryly.
"Well, no, honey, I can't say we saw that one coming. That doesn't really matter, though, not for you two."
She put down her knitting and sighed.
"That big mess up in New York that you were in. Well, the second it was on the news, Sam was on his way up there. He got there in time to help dig people out. Spent 3 months there, counseling, helping people get into the programs."
Steve nodded. He hadn't known, but it wasn't anything like a surprise.
"He's the kind that runs toward when everybody else is running away," she said. "And so are you. I don't really feel the need to worry about how your neighbors are going to treat you when there's Nazis and aliens shooting at you. The kind of people who would give you a hard time, they're going to be too busy hiding behind you. That's not my concern."
Steve took a deep breath.
"But you've got one," he said.
She was silent a moment.
"I don't know whether to say," she said. "Sam would be angry with me, and for this he'd have a right to be. He's a grown man, and he has a right to expect me to trust his judgment, and I do."
"If there's anything you can ask me that would make you feel better," Steve said, "I'd like you to. I'd like to feel better about it myself, if I could."
"I know you're a good man," she said, "and the things you'll put before Sam, he'd put before himself. But that's a long list on his side. I guess I worry that means he never gets to come first with you."
"I want him to," Steve said, low. "I want to give him everything."
She nodded.
"Well, that's a start."
The front door opened.
"So you all wanted broccoli, anchovy, pineapple, right?"
Sam called, and the kids spilled downstairs yelling protests that silenced only when they got the boxes open. Sam had brought one large with broccoli just for Steve, and the kids had their solid meat pizza unsullied. Jerusha's plain slice had one tiny piece of anchovy. She ate it and triumphantly said, "I do like anchovies," and then spat the anchovy bite out onto the plate before going on with her slice. Sam grinned at Steve and passed him a cold beer, letting his thigh press up along Steve's under the table, a secret connection that made Steve flush pink all over again and dart guilty looks across the table, where all the women looked like they were struggling between being half embarrassed and trying not to laugh.
"I can't take you anywhere,"
Sam murmured in his ear, suppressed laughter in his voice too.
"I can't help it,"
Steve hissed back, and bent down over his pizza to hide his face, blinking back a sudden bright, stinging feeling in his eyes, because maybe it really could be this simple, after all. In the morning, the night before they'd closed the door and looked at each other, at the wall separating them from the kids' bedroom, back at each other.
"Think we could keep it quiet?"
Sam said doubtfully.
"No,"
Steve said. "No," Sam agreed, sighing. So they'd gone to bed. In the morning, they woke up and looked at each other across the room, and Sam smiled at him, sleepy and warm. Steve couldn't help getting out of bed and going to him for kisses, Sam's hand cupping his head. He ended up in the bed, and they both groaned very softly, moving against each other, recognizing how bad an idea that had been.
"Okay,"
Sam said.
"We gotta get up."
"Yeah," Steve said. They kept kissing until a sudden furious banging on the door started, complete with giggling, and Jerusha's voice faintly asking,
"Now can we go in?"
Steve nearly levitated off Sam and across the room just in time to grab the covers before the kids burst through. Lena's oldest daughter, Arpa, was there behind them, smirking, and Sam glared at her.
"Don't give me that look,"
she said, laughing as she walked away.
"You know the house rules."
"What are the house rules?"
Steve said, trying to keep the covers over himself. The kids were all jumping wildly on the beds.
You don't get a door that locks unless you make it official, Sam said sourly.
Can't even do it in this state,
he yelled after her.
Excuses, excuses,
floated back from downstairs. They went down for breakfast, and then settled in the living room with the yellow pages and a local map, calling hardware stores one after another in widening circles around the motel. They made it nearly 15 miles out, and Steve was starting to quit hoping, when the guy on the other end said,
Power drill? For $65.93? That's what we charge for the B&D after tax. I think I just had to restock that one. Hang on, I'll have a look. This past week?
Since Wednesday, Steve said, sitting up on the couch, his heart pounding, and after about 10 minutes the guy came back and said,
Yeah, we sold our next to last one on Thursday. Hey, Ricky,
he was calling to someone on his end. You remember ringing up a B&D on Thursday? And after a pause he was back, saying,
Yeah, he remembers it. Said the guy was a weirdo, wearing a glove, like Michael Jackson or something.
Do you have the records? Steve said, his hands almost shaking. The guy hesitated.
Well, who do you say you were with? Is this like a police thing?
You know what? Steve said. I'll be there in 15 minutes, and you can decide if you're comfortable showing it to me.
Or if you're going to have to knock over a hardware store and steal their records,
Sam said dryly, after Steve hung up, already getting the car keys.
No, dude, I'm driving. You sit your ass in the passenger seat and try not to hyperventilate yourself out the window.
The hardware store owner decided he was fine showing Captain America the sale record. Steve snatched it and called the credit card number into Natasha before he even said thank you.
I'll look into it, she said. Don't get your hopes up too high, Rogers. He hasn't shown any signs of incompetence so far. He won't have used it more than once.
If he hasn't, can you find out anything else? Steve said.
When I know, you'll know, she said, and hung up.
Sam put a hand on his shoulder.
Come on, he said. We'll take the kids to the park.
They fed ducks and played tag and soccer for hours, until Jerusha abruptly switched off around 2 p.m. and had to be carried back to the car, already fast asleep. Back at the house, Steve quit trying to pretend he wasn't waiting for the phone to ring and just sat on the couch, staring at it. He ate dinner because he could always eat. Afterwards, he went back to the living room, the sounds of the kids' bath and bedtime in the background. They quieted at last, and Sam came in and settled next to him with his laptop, in comforting silence, his hand on Steve's thigh. Steve closed his eyes and leaned back against the couch and let his head rest on Sam's shoulder. He drifted off and jerked up about an hour later, darkness outside and the hallway light off, faint noise of a television from upstairs. Next to him, Sam was sitting up, blinking, rubbing a hand over his face. The phone was ringing, an untraceable number. Steve grabbed it.
Natasha?
Yeah, she said. Congratulations, you hit the jackpot.
He used it again?
Wait, he said, and switched to speakerphone so Sam could hear.
Okay, go ahead.
No, of course he didn't, she said. But I tracked the number to a data breach at an online retailer from 3 months ago. They were hacked by a credit card trafficking group, a small Russian mafia group operating out of Florida that distributes numbers along the East Coast.
Where in Florida?
Steve asked, grabbing pen and paper.
Don't start planning a trip, she said. They have a reputation for being protective of their clients, but I was able to persuade them to cooperate.
How? Steve said. I paid them a lot of Stark's money, she said. Not everything has to be complicated.
Oh, Steve said, a little dismayed. These guys were crooks, stealing from regular people.
Is that a complaint? Natasha said, with an edge, and Steve winced.
No, he said meekly.
Good, she said, because your pal bought in bulk. He got more than 1,000 numbers with a single lump payment he transferred to them from an offshore account I'm pretty sure was Hydra. They gave me the whole list. Do you have a printer there?
Yeah, Sam said, glancing over at a printer next to the computer on a small desk in the corner of the room. You need me to do something?
Is your laptop on the network with it? She said. Never mind, I see it.
Say yes to that, she added, as a dialog box popped open on Sam's screen. He clicked OK, and after a moment the printer whirred up.
I'm sending you a map of the transactions on all the cards he's already used.
Sam got up to get it while she went on. I have the remaining 23 numbers from his last batch all flagged. When he uses one of them, I'll get a notification.
How soon will it be? Steve said urgently, leaning over the phone.
No way of knowing, she said. It's been as much as 2 weeks between transactions. He probably uses some of them for cash withdrawals.
What about the last one?
It was the night before the bar incident. Hold on, I'll get the details.
The phone went mute. Steve shoved his hands into his hair. They were so fucking close. Abruptly, Sam shot past him, across the room to the hallway, shouting, "Arpa, Maya, get the kids up right now! Aunt Lena!"
Steve stood up, his heart pounding. "Sam, what the—"
Sam turned, his face grim, and shoved the sheet from the printer at him. Steve took it and looked down. Natasha had made a key shaded by date. There were older, faded points scattered up and down the East Coast, in obscure places. But the more recent ones, the darker points, were concentrated in three big clusters: New York, Atlanta, and a place just outside Philadelphia, each one roughing out the shape of a circle. Sam pointed to the centers.
"That's my mom's house, that's my sister Darlene's place, and that is here."
He spoke flatly. The sheet was crumpling in Steve's hands. He couldn't look up at Sam's face. Horror was a sick knot in his throat. Every worst-case scenario he'd ever dreamed of was crumbling away, like a child's fear of ghosts or shadows, silly and almost a little laughable. He'd never been able to imagine anything as bad as this. Voices were calling questions downstairs. Ruth, Lena, the others. Sam was turning, going out into the hallway, calling up to them. Steve stood frozen, unable to move. "No luck. Last charge was 2 days before the bar incident." Natasha's voice broke in. "He went to an Army-Navy store, bought a laser sight and a knife and a pair of pants. Nothing useful. It was about 5 miles from your current—" "What's going on?" she said sharply. Steve almost couldn't speak.
"It's Sam," he said, his voice cracking. "The clusters. They're Sam's family. Bucky is— he's—"
Natasha said, "Stop him!" Steve flinched, the world swimming nauseous around him. "Sam!" Natasha was shouting crackly over the phone. "Sam! Stop him!" she said to Steve. "Don't let him turn on the lights. Don't let him get them moving." Sam appeared in the doorway, frowning. "What's she saying?"
"Sam, don't change anything," she said. "Don't give any indication you've discovered the surveillance. That can be an automatic kill trigger, depending on what he thinks his mission parameters are. For the moment, you all need to act exactly as you normally do." "That's not an option," Sam said. "There are kids in this house, Natasha."
"Do you think you're going to keep them safe by triggering an attack by the Winter Soldier?" she said, and Sam put his hands on his hips and dropped his head, taking a deep breath. "Now listen to me. Do you have a basement room there? Preferably one with no windows."
"Yeah."
"Good," she said. "Keep the lights exactly as they are. Close the blinds in the children's room and then move them into the basement, keeping them out of sight of any windows. Do the same for the adults, but only when it's the usual time for them to go to sleep. Then cover the entrance to the basement and sit tight. I'll be there with a full extraction team in 4 hours, and I'm sending teams to your mother and sister's addresses now as well. Don't do anything else until I get there. I'm on my way."
The plan helped, a little. Steve locked in on it with single-minded desperation. He and Sam worked quickly, no words wasted, slipping into the grown-ups' bedrooms out of sight of the windows to tell them what was going on.
"I'll go close the blinds in the kids' room," Maya said. After she was done, they moved them downstairs. Jerusha didn't even stir as Steve carried her. Miriam said drowsily, "Are we having a slumber party?" All four of them went back to sleep in the nest made out of rugs and sleeping bags and winter coats, whatever Sam had dug up out of the basement storage. By then it was getting late, after 11. One by one, the rest of them all turned out their lights and crept carefully out of their dark bedrooms and down into the basement. Steve sat in the hallway next to the basement door, arms resting on top of his knees, head bowed. He could hear Sam's voice down the stairs. He'd gotten a shotgun and a hunting rifle out of the locked gun safe in the basement. He was telling Arpa and Maya how to hold and fire the rifle. Steve almost couldn't breathe, his whole body a clenched fist. He remembered this feeling, his lungs struggling against his ribs, closing in on himself, trapped. It felt the same. It felt the same. His mind circled around and around. He'd told himself Bucky had spared him, saved him. Had he been lying to himself all along? Sam came up the stairs slowly and settled in next to him, the shotgun resting against the wall between them, in easy reach. The front porch light flickered in through the glass panel and gleamed on the metal barrels. The house was still and quiet, the faint whir of the ceiling fan in the living room gently stirring around, the big old clock in the hallway ticking, and occasional headlamps going by in the street outside. The phone buzzed in Steve's pocket, and he yanked it out, Natasha calling again. "You can relax a little," she said. "He's not there right now. Another number just went through, 2 miles from you. Where was it?" Steve said sharply, and Natasha hesitated. "Where?" "An ATM at the Royalton Motorhome on Bellevue Lane. Rogers, wait for me. Get here as fast as you can," he said, and hung up the phone. His hand closed tight around it. He stood up. Sam stood up with him. Steve swallowed. "I'm going after him," he said harshly.
"I know,"
Sam said.
"I'm sorry I can't come with you."
Steve still couldn't look Sam in the face.
I won't let him hurt them,"
he told the floor, his voice tight.
"I promise, Sam."
Sam didn't speak for a moment.
"You think I need you to tell me that?"
he said. Steve flinched. Sam reached out, turned him, and raised him up to meet Sam's eyes. Not angry at all. A worry that was almost worse than anger.
"I know you'll stop him," Sam said quietly. "The guy we're out here looking for, the guy you loved, he'd want you to stop him. You'll do that for him. That's not what you got to promise me, Steve. You've got to promise me you're coming back after."
And Steve was abruptly back in those horrible moments on the helicarrier, that brutal fight, having to hurt Bucky with his own hands, knowing everything that had happened to Bucky, everything that had been done to him. And after all that, now even Steve was hurting him, the one person Bucky should have been able to trust, to rely on, the one person who should have comforted him, and instead the sickening crack of Bucky's arm, hearing him scream. He'd wanted to be sick. He'd wanted to... The guy who'd done that to Bucky didn't deserve to. Steve dragged in a breath, a sob.
"I know what I'm asking you,"
Sam said.
"Everything you had got taken. I know this is one more thing than you could bear, but I'm asking anyway. I know it'll be hard. It can be hard. It can be hard a long time. But I need you to come back to me. Can you promise me that?"
There were tears running hot down Steve's face. And, God, it would be hard forever. He hadn't imagined anything like this, because he couldn't bear it. He couldn't bear to be left behind, alone again, after he'd had to shove Bucky off into the dark. He wanted to despair. He wanted to let go. Except he wasn't alone. He wasn't alone anymore, if he was faithful, if he'd meant it, when he'd asked Sam for everything he had to give. Steve took a ragged step forward into Sam's arms, and Sam held him. Sam wrapped him close.
"I promise,"
Steve said, his voice shaking.
"Sam, I promise."
He cupped Sam's head and kissed him once, hard, desperately, and then he wrenched himself away and slipped out the front door, taking the car keys from the basket. The motel was dingy and run down, cheap. The clerk was a yawning teenager, playing a noisy beeping game on his phone. The grimy ATM in the corner had a small plaque posted at the top saying, $5 fee.
"Someone just rented a room here," Steve said, 10 minutes ago, with cash he got from that machine.
"Dude, that's like super creepy. Are you like the NSA or something?"
the kid said, without looking up.
"Ever hear of privacy?"
Steve slammed his fists on the counter. The whole thing shook. The goldfish bowl holding business cards jumped. The kid jerked back, wide-eyed, and then stared at him.
"Which room?"
Steve said ferociously, and the kid swallowed and squeaked out, "Number 14, and gave Steve the housekeeping master key with a shaking hand. Steve slung the shield onto his arm and circled around to the room. The blinds were down, and the door was locked. He opened the bottom lock and waited, but nothing came. He jammed the edge of the shield into the doorframe and levered it open fast. The bolt burst off the wall, and the door swung open, letting the parking lot lights into a dark room, a single duffel bag on the bed, a hooded jacket and gloves thrown next to it, a laptop sitting on the desk. The shower was running behind the closed bathroom door. Steve stood inside Bucky's room, his heart pounding. He turned on a light and looked into the duffel. There was a thin layer of clothes, a Ziploc bag full of cash, another full of passports. The rest was weapons. A sniper rifle in parts, 3 handguns, 6 knives in varied sizes. There were some ropes and zip ties and handcuffs. Steve took the zip ties and cuffs and one of the guns.
He unloaded all the others and tossed the whole duffel outside the door. He shut it and locked the bottom door lock again. He touched the laptop. It hadn't been asleep long enough to go behind a password prompt. There were folders on the desktop full of photographs, documents, tax returns, property deeds, bank accounts and utility bills, birth and death and marriage certificates, detailed reports and thousands of photographs covering the most ordinary errands, grocery shopping to laundry. The lives of Sam's family slid under a microscope. There were photographs of the kids at the goddamn zoo, Jerusha's face tilted up to be painted into a tiger. Steve swallowed around the sick knot deep in his throat and closed the lid. The water shut off. Steve went to stand in front of the lamp, the shield ready. A few moments later, Bucky whirled around out the bathroom door, a knife flying straight for the lamp. Steve knocked it away with the shield and pointed the gun straight at Bucky's head. He was less than 10 feet away across the tiny motel room. It wasn't a shot he could miss. "Stand down," he said, his voice tight. "Stand down." Bucky held motionless a moment, crouched. He had pulled on his pants and boots, but his hair still hung long and dripping around his head. He had another knife in his metal hand. And then abruptly he relaxed, straightening. "Shit," he said. "The credit cards, huh? Thought I paid them enough to keep their mouths shut." He sounded so much like Bucky. Steve didn't trust himself to answer. He jerked his chin towards the bag of zip ties on the bed. "Throw the other knife on the bed. Zip tie your ankles and cuff the metal wrist." Bucky shrugged a little with one shoulder and didn't move. "Then what?" "I'll figure it out when we get there," Steve said grimly. Bucky huffed a short laugh. "Star-spangled man with no plan," he said, the corner of a smile crossing his face, brief and gone. "It's not a good idea, Steve." "You can talk me out of it after you're restrained," Steve said. He didn't let the gun waver, but he couldn't help saying, "Please, please don't make me..." Bucky muttered something under his breath in Russian, but Steve could tell it was cursing anyway. Then abruptly Bucky threw the knife, end over end, thunking solidly into the wall above the bed, and he picked up a zip tie and bent down to get his ankles. Steve watched close, but Bucky wasn't trying to cheat it. He got the tie tight, and after he cuffed his metal arm, he turned around to offer his wrists together behind his back. Steve edged in, slowly, watching for any twitch of movement. His hand wanted to shake. He reached out and got the other cuff closed around Bucky's wrist, squeezing tight. "Hey, ow," Bucky said, grumbling, just like himself. And Steve suddenly wanted to punch him in the face. He grabbed Bucky by the shoulders and turned him around and shoved him down on the bed. "What the hell are you doing?" he said. "What are you..." He stopped and gulped air and said, levelly, "Do you remember me?" Bucky actually rolled his eyes. "James Buchanan Barnes, serial number..." "Jesus Christ!" Steve yelled. "Yeah, I remember," Bucky snapped. "I remember a whole fucking lot of things. Because it turns out one of the things this super soldier juice does to you is it fixes you, and it keeps fixing you. And once your brain stops getting fried every few months, it starts working again just fine. I remember you. I remember Mama Leone's. I remember my 48-digit Hydra passcode. I remember murdering 63 civilians, okay, you fucking asshole? I remember. That what you want to hear?" He was yelling by then, too, and Steve was shaking, sick at heart. "Yes, I do want to hear it. I'd have given anything to hear it, you jerk. Months now, and you've known. You know I would have..." "You would have what?" Bucky said. "Help me? I don't need help, okay? I'm fine. The stuff I've got to do, you're not going to be a part of." "And what's that?" Steve said. "What have you got to do?" "Burn Hydra to the ground," Bucky said, flatly. "Oh, right!" Steve said, his voice rising again, "because I sure wouldn't want anything to do with that." Bucky looked straight up at him, his mouth a hard line, his eyes utterly unfamiliar. He was someone else suddenly, a man who had murdered 63 people. "You wouldn't," the Winter Soldier said, cold as 30 below. "Not the way I'm going to do it." Steve pulled himself back in, trying to calm down. Bucky wasn't okay. He might sound like himself. He might almost be himself. He might be all in one piece, and his brain might even be working fine. That was still a long way off from okay, and yelling at him wasn't going to make him better. He was abruptly sorry he hadn't waited for Natasha, that Sam wasn't with him. Feeling the sudden, sharp, painful certainty,
He wasn't the guy Bucky needed doing this. He was almost as twisted up by what had been done to Bucky as Bucky was himself. Except there was a reason Sam wasn't with him, and that had to come first. Bucky would have put it first himself, if he was really okay.
"Why are you following Sam's family?" Steve said, low and level. "What do you think, I'm planning to assassinate a bunch of school kids?"
Bucky said, a bitter edge to the words,
was gathering intel. "On Sam?" "Yeah, on Sam."
Bucky shook his head, exasperation.
"Christ, Rogers, you knew the guy for a week and you started living in his pocket. You don't know shit about him." "He's my friend," Steve said. "Oh, bullshit," Bucky said. "He saved my life. From you, you dickhead."
Steve was yelling again.
"If it wasn't for him, Hydra would have gotten those helicarriers." "No, I mean bullshit," Bucky said, glaring up at him. "Am I a moron? You think I can't spot you making a goddamn idiot out of yourself from a mile away? I saw you with him outside Jersey 6 weeks ago. You were practically doodling Mrs. Sam Wilson on your notebooks."
Steve gawked at him.
"What?"
Bucky shrugged.
"Somebody had to check the guy out. You sure as hell weren't going to do it. Unless you mean checking out his..." "I'm going to kick yours," Steve said, turning red all over.
"Adorable face," Bucky finished. Pitched saccharine sweet. He snorted.
"Even in the 21st century, you can't just get yourself laid like a normal guy. It's all or nothing with you."
Steve braced a hand behind his head, staring around the room, almost wildly. He didn't even know what to do.
"That's why. That's why you've been stalking his entire family. They weren't supposed to know about it, dumbass," Bucky said. "I bet you freaked all of them out, too."
"Yes," Steve shouted.
"Yes, I did. How was I supposed to know? I thought...
His voice was breaking. Bucky scowled and looked away.
"You can't look after yourself, so somebody's got to do it,"
he muttered after a moment.
"I didn't know if he was up to the job."
Steve turned away, shoving his hands into his hair.
"So, what did you find on this critical information-gathering mission?"
"He seems okay," Bucky said grudgingly.
"He's got nice folks."
Steve huffed out a laugh, helpless, and then he was laughing full out, and then he was sinking into the one creaky chair and covering his face and crying, and then Bucky was there, the broken cuffs dangling from his wrist, gripping his shoulders, saying awkwardly,
"Jesus, Rogers, you don't see me getting fucking weepy."
Steve grabbed him by the shoulders.
"You're coming home," he said.
"Bucky, you're coming home with me."
"Yeah?"
Bucky said.
"What's your boyfriend going to think about that?"
"He's going to punch you in the face," Steve said, "and then he's going to let you stay."
"Oh, really?"
Bucky said.
"Yeah, really,"
Steve said. "He loves me." He wiped his face on his sleeve and gasped a little, catching his breath.
"He loves me, Buck." "Yeah, yeah,"
Bucky said and sighed.
"All right, fine already. Take me to meet the in-laws."
Sam was quiet for almost a solid minute after Steve told him.
Are you okay?"
Steve said, a little nervously.
"I was at DEFCON 2, Rogers. It's taken me a while to wind back down to whatever this calls for, which I don't even know."
Sam said,
"Did you maybe punch him a couple of times?"
"I thought you might want to do the honors," Steve said.
"You hit harder,"
Sam said dryly.
"Okay, I'm going to go let everybody get back to their beds and call off Natasha. Bring him for breakfast tomorrow if he can behave like a civilized person and eat at the table instead of up in a tree outside or something."
He was waiting outside the house the next morning, leaning back against the doorframe with his arms crossed and his face a little hard and worried. Bucky eyed Steve calculatingly, like he was hoping to find some way of getting out of this, and then he gave up and climbed out of the car. Steve followed him up the stairs, covering the escape route, and Bucky stopped in front of Sam, hands in his pockets, shoulders hunching in a little. It hurt to see. Bucky, who'd always stood wide open and cocky, chin up at the world and smug about it, and Steve looked away to catch Sam looking at him, softened. Sam looked back at Bucky.
3 months, dude," he said, but mildly.
Bucky's shoulders uncurled, going back instinctively to answer the challenge.
"What, you would have rather have had a third wheel?" "I would rather not have been chasing your spying ass across the entire country,"
Sam said, but he was smiling a little, and then he held out a hand.
"Sam Wilson."
Bucky stared at it a long moment, and then slowly he put out his own and took it.
"Bucky Barnes,"
he said, a little roughly, and Steve felt a breath ease out of him.
it was going to be okay.
Sorry,
Bucky muttered.
Seriously, though, Sam said, opening the door. What kind of spy are you, anyway? It took you more than a month to check out a bunch of grandmas and kindergartners? Yeah, well, it got you under Rogers' skirt, so I don't see why you're complaining,
Bucky retorted.
Bucky?
Steve squawked, blushing.
Oh, just wait. You got plenty more complaining coming,
Sam said.
My entire family was up in the middle of the night. You're going to be getting a hard time every holiday for the next 10-20 years or so.
He held the door open.
Come on in. Coffee's ready.
Breaking news. Written by Astolat. Read by Quiet Knight. Part 2 of Maybe Home is Somewhere I'm Going. There wasn't anything wrong with the house. At least, nothing wrong that buying the four neighboring properties on each side and doing a 20-mil renovation wouldn't fix. It was so ordinary that Tony had to use a satellite map overlay on his phone to pick it out of the block, and there couldn't have been more than two bedrooms in the place. The car in the driveway was a beater, and the driveway itself was so narrow that the motorcycle had to be parked ahead of it.
"Seriously, Jarvis, you're sure this is where he lives?"
Tony said, and banged on the front door, even as Jarvis made a pissy deal of confirming. A stranger opened the door, a black guy Tony had never seen before, tall, built, military written all over him. Literally, he was wearing an Air Force sweatshirt, dark down the front with fresh sweat stains, and a scattering of grass stains, too, like he'd been wrestling with a lawn somewhere.
"Hey, weird question. Does Captain America live here?"
Tony said. The guy was staring at him, but in an unusual way. He'd obviously recognized Tony, which, no kidding, but the stare wasn't a "holy shit, it's Tony Stark" stare, or the second level, "can I ask for his autograph?" or even the third level, "what tabloid can I sell this to?" Tony couldn't actually identify the particular quality of the stare until the guy said dryly,
"So this is going to be a thing, huh?"
And it turned out to be something like resigned. That was new.
"Just tell me up front, have aliens invaded again?" "Not to my knowledge, which means pretty much no,"
Tony said.
"Can I? Thanks,"
he said, eeling in. He pulled off his sunglasses and took a look around. The interior was fully as ordinary as the exterior. The TV wasn't even as much as 50 inches.
"No, I just need to talk to him about a topic of mutual interest. And you are?"
"Sam Wilson," the guy said.
"Steve's in the shower. Make yourself at home."
He waved a hand at the living room.
"Coffee will be up in about 5 minutes. I'm more of a smoothie kind of guy,"
Tony said.
"If you want to make yourself one, go ahead,"
Wilson said, sounding amused, and turned as Steve Rogers came into the room in almost all of his not-insubstantial glory, saved only by the towel tucked around his hips and the one he was using to dry off his head.
"Is that victory I smell?"
he was saying, making a loud sniffing noise.
"That's probably just me,"
Tony said, and Steve jerked up out of the towel.
"No aliens,"
Wilson said, patting Steve on the arm as he headed past him.
"I checked. Don't drink all my coffee while I'm showering."
"My coffee?" Steve said, half-heartedly taking a snap at him with the towel, and looked at Tony.
"What's this about?"
Tony waited until he heard the bathroom door close and the shower start running again.
"Another attempt to persuade you to listen to reason," he said. "But before I get into that, fill me in. Who's the new boyfriend? I don't know anything about him. Why don't I know anything about him? What's he doing here?"
Steve said, "this is his house." Tony frowned.
"You live here?"
Yeah, Steve said. I moved in a few months ago. It's still Sam's house.
Seriously,
Tony said.
You're frozen in ice for 70 years and the DOD wouldn't spring for back pay?
Steve was staring at him like Tony was speaking a foreign language. I can afford my own place.
So what are you... Wait, he's actually your boyfriend?
Tony said. Steve blushed, literally, a visible pink flushed wave that swept all the way down his chest.
Yes,
he said, managing to sound smug and embarrassed at the same time.
Holy shit, are you out of your mind?
Tony said, staring.
Excuse me?
Steve said.
I've sent you keys,
Tony said.
I've emailed. I've texted. I've called. Pepper's called. There is an entire floor of Stark Tower waiting for you to move in. And instead, here you are living in a two-bedroom shack out in the open with your... Extremely hot, by the way. Nice job there. Boyfriend. The paparazzi are going to eat you alive, Rogers.
They're fine, Steve said. I know most of the ones who take pictures of me. They're not bad guys.
They are not fine, Tony said. They just haven't realized yet. Probably because it hasn't occurred to them that you could be insane enough to be pulling this stunt. And when they do figure it out, they are going to go into a blood-maddened frenzy that will only be made worse because you managed to cover it up for this long.
I'm not covering anything up, Steve said. We live together.
Have you held a press conference to discuss your sexuality?
Tony said.
What?
No, Steve said, recoiling with a horrified expression.
Then you are secretly dating a man,
Tony said.
It's not... We're engaged, Steve said.
Dear God, Tony said. He groped over to the armchair and sank into it, covering his eyes.
The only saving grace,
he said, muffled from behind his hand,
is that I found out before you went in and got the license, which I'm assuming you would have done in the middle of the day, in uniform, blowing a bugle. Jesus.
Steve rolled his eyes and went into the kitchen and started pouring himself coffee. Tony pulled out his phone.
Jarvis, get Pepper for me stat, on a secure line and tell her I don't care what she has to interrupt.
Oh my God, Tony, what? Pepper said in a moment over the phone. What's happened? Are you okay?
Steve's engaged.
Tony said.
To a guy.
Steve? Pepper said, bewildered.
Steve Rogers,
Tony said. Who is... Wait, do you mean Captain America?
Wow, really?
She said. Then her inner nice person kicked in. What I mean is, that's wonderful, obviously.
No, it is not wonderful, Tony said. It is the direct opposite of wonderful. We need to get our PR people started on a full-scale crisis management plan.
What? Steve reappeared.
You don't want people to know, so your idea is to tell your entire staff?
I do not want people to know, Tony said, lowering the phone.
You do not want people to know, and your brilliant plan for achieving this goal appears to be running around waving a rainbow flag and hoping nobody notices you. I, on the other hand, recognize the obvious and absolute futility of concealing something like this for any length of time, and want the release of information to be controlled in a manageable fashion, so you don't get hunted down like an elk by the entire paparazzi population of the East Coast.
The conversation devolved from there. After about 10 minutes, they got interrupted when Wilson suddenly shouted, "Hey!" in a parade ground voice, and they both stopped yelling and jerked to look at him. He was leaning against the doorway to the living room, dressed and arms folded across his chest.
He said, I was going to let you two finish, but I don't have all day, and it looks like that's what it would take.
He came in the room, picked up the cup of coffee Steve had abandoned on the mantel, and put it in his hands.
Take your coffee and go cool off out back.
Steve was still flushed and glaring at Tony.
Sam, we don't need to...
Dude, Sam said.
When somebody from the bomb squad shows up and tells you there's an IED in the road up ahead, you don't keep going just because the guy's a jerk.
Oh, now I'm a jerk, Tony said.
For wanting to save you from self-inflicted asphyxiation caused by shoving your head in the sand. You've been a jerk all along,
Steve snapped, taking a step, but Sam's hand flat on his chest stopped him.
Now,
Sam said firmly, and Steve abruptly took the coffee out of his hand and went.
Does that work on you in bed, too?
Tony called after him. He wasn't above meanly enjoying the flush that went running bright red all over Steve's shoulders.
Oh, I'm sorry, was that embarrassing? Did I wound your tender sensibilities?
Sam stepped into his line of sight, as the door banged shut behind Steve, and Tony transferred the glare to him.
Listen, pal, I don't care how much you like the white picket fence life. If you think that's bad, just wait until TMZ is on your doorstep. You want me to come up with a few more questions they might have?
Actually, Sam said,
I'm a black man engaged to Captain America, so I'm a little more concerned about firebombs through the front window, which is why Steve's out back, and I'm here talking to you, instead of putting you out on the stoop for winding up my man.
I was not winding, Tony began. Sam looked at him.
Tony stopped.
After a moment, he tried to say, in my defense, but Sam's eyebrow came up,
And Tony discovered he had to stop that, too.
What the hell?
Tony eyed Sam narrowly.
Okay, seriously, who are you?
He demanded.
No, wait,
he said, getting his phone back out.
Jarvis, who is he?
Samuel Thomas Wilson, the former pararescue man who assisted Captain Rogers during the recent Inside incident, Jarvis said. He was the individual wearing the wings. I'm accessing his service record now. Sam was watching him with more of that resignation.
I'm guessing people have probably mentioned to you before that your interpersonal communication could use some work. I don't want to communicate with people. People are boring,
Tony said absently.
Most people,
he added. The military records were opening up on his screen as Jarvis got into the databases. Air Force, 58th Pararescue, top scores on virtually every metric in training, a variety of citations for what looked at a glance to be a large number of insanely dangerous rescue missions, seconded to EX-07 classified project. Aha, there were the wings. A little crude, he could do better. 2 tours, technical sergeant, 2 years of a degree at Georgetown, certified peer support. Oh shit.
You're a shrink,
Tony said accusingly.
Dude, I haven't even got through college yet,
Sam said.
Speaking of which, I got class in an hour. It's college, you can skip it,
Tony said.
I didn't attend more than 5% of my undergraduate classes. I'm guessing you built a couple more buildings for your college than I can afford,
Sam said.
You want to give me some life advice? Keep it to handling the press, okay? Fine,
Tony said, putting away his phone.
First of all, you need to move into the towers of yesterday. Let's start smaller,
Sam said.
No, there is no smaller, Tony said. You have 5 immediate neighbors. They'll all be offered something like $10,000 a week to park television and camera equipment on their properties. You have 6 windows facing the street, so there will be cars parked up and down both sides of the entire block 24 hours a day with cameras pointed at them. Whenever you walk out your front door, at least 10 guys will be there yelling personal questions of varyingly offensive degrees trying to get you to react. Firebombs? Don't worry about firebombs. Nobody who wants to firebomb your house is going to be able to get to you through the wall of press. This is not a controllable location. Seriously, what do you guys have against a penthouse in Manhattan? Is it some kind of reverse snob thing?
I got nothing against a Manhattan penthouse, Sam said.
I think Steve's got some concerns about moving into your place, though. I can't imagine why.
Yeah, well, you talked him into moving in here, didn't you? Tony said.
Work with me. Moving in here, Steve traded in loneliness and a 3rd bedroom for blowjobs and pancakes. That wasn't what you call a hard sell,
Sam said, which Tony couldn't really argue with, to be fair.
Just step it back a little. You said this place isn't controllable. Point taken. So we'll find some place that is, whether it's your place or someplace else. What else?
Tony scowled.
For the record, that's making me really uncomfortable. The whole reasonableness thing. We'll get Steve back up here before I leave. The two of you can be dramatic at each other for a while to make up for it.
Sam said.
What else?
Tony ticked off on his fingers.
You have to pick a major publication to come out in, probably Time, and start leaking the story in bits and pieces for at least a month. Go to all the major gossip buyers and give all of them contracts for exclusive content that require them not to go buy from the freelancers.
Sam was shaking his head.
We're not doing press.
Yes, you are, Tony said.
Listen to me. This isn't... You guys aren't movie stars. You are superheroes. You are politically relevant. You are newsworthy. And that means you are handing every news organization in the world, no matter how snooty, a gold-plated excuse to run a fabulously prurient gossip story for 24 hours a day, and your willing involvement will not be required for them to keep it going until the end of time. There is only one way you're going to get it to calm down, and that is overexposure. You need to be everywhere on everything. You need to tell people just about everything they want to know. Incidentally, the two of you will have to articulate an explicit political position on every issue affecting gay people, and you'll probably have to have one on every issue affecting black people, too. And after about a month, 2 months, it'll die down. Until the wedding. Please tell me you're planning a long engagement.
We got 3 weeks left, Sam said.
Semester's almost over. After my finals, we're going up to New York, and my uncle's doing the ceremony.
Well, this is going to be a disaster of epic proportions, Tony said. At least the happy lovebirds saw some of the folly of their ways. Sam listed the house for sale that weekend. Tony bought it immediately for cash, through a charming pair of actors, one of whom was heavily pregnant. They attended the first open house, said the house was perfect because it was one block from the grandparents, and asked plaintively if they could maybe move in soon, and for that matter, if there was any furniture Sam would like to sell. Sam called later that night and said,
"Okay, we're going to give the tower a try."
And Tony magnanimously refrained from yelling, "About time!" into the phone loud enough for Rogers to overhear on the other side. Instead, he waited until he had hung up.
"Tony," Pepper said,
without looking up from whatever paperwork she was paying attention to, instead of him, at the moment.
"Look, you of all people should realize the horrific magnitude of this situation," Tony said.
"Where, by situation, you mean that Captain America is madly in love and he's going to get married?" Pepper said.
"Exactly,"
Tony said. "I think it's sweet," Pepper said.
"Sweet like cute fluffy little lambs going to slaughter,"
Tony said.
"Yes, that's exactly the kind of sweet it is. We have less than 2 weeks left to do damage control here, and they won't even let me hire movers for them."
"Tony, we've talked about this, okay?" Pepper said. "You need to give them some space."
"I'm giving them an entire floor," Tony said. "Hell, they can have two if they want. We'll knock a hole and run a staircase down if they want to duplex it."
"One'll do us,"
Sam said the next weekend, when they finally moved in, having carried up their own boxes from a U-Haul truck currently parked next to Tony's chartreuse Lamborghini. To be fair, Steve could probably have lifted the entire truck if he'd had to, and Sam wasn't exactly a slouch in the department of lifting heavy objects, but honestly.
"We'll need another key, though,"
Sam added.
"For who?"
Tony said. Steve was standing shoulder-slumped in the middle of the 2,000-square-foot living room with a view of the Empire State Building and the Cabretta leather couch, his hands shoved in his pockets, and a look on his face like somebody was making him eat a bad sandwich.
"None of your business,"
Sam said pleasantly, and just as Tony's brain was about to start revving up, caught him by the arm and looked him seriously in the face.
"Is this our home or not?"
That was going to continue to be wildly annoying.
"Yes, fine, it's your home," Tony said grumpily. "Jarvis can print you all the keys you want. Jarvis, get him another one."
"Very good, sir," Jarvis said from the ceiling speaker.
"How do we turn him off?"
Steve said, turning around.
"Jarvis? You can't turn Jarvis off,"
Tony said.
"If I'm going to live under 24-hour surveillance, I might as well be doing it with a paparazzi," Steve said sharply. "Jarvis, are the cameras in here on?"
Tony demanded.
"No, sir,"
Jarvis answered.
"See? What's the problem?"
Tony said.
"He's listening," Steve said. "He's on call," Tony said. "He's listening all the time," Steve said.
"If I may say, sir, I am only listening for actionable commands directed at myself," Jarvis said. "I am very good at disregarding all other conversations and, for that matter, any other remarks made to me, an essential function of my neural network, as Mr. Stark is sadly given to large quantities of irrelevant commentary."
"Hey,"
Tony said. "Also, Miss Potts has strictly ordered me to respect the privacy of our guests," Jarvis added.
"See, there you go,"
Tony said.
"I promise we won't be snooping to find out who's on top."
Steve, about to say something else, paused and frowned.
"On top of what?" "Jesus, it's like watching the axe coming down," Tony said, bridging his forehead. "I'll fill you in later,"
Sam said, patting Steve's shoulder.
"Jarvis, can we tell you to shut off the mics when we want to?"
"Certainly, Mr. Wilson."
"Make it, Sam."
"As you wish, Sam," Jarvis said. "And if I may add, only authorized keyholders will be permitted to reactivate any of the audio-visual recording facilities." Sam looked at Tony.
"I think I like him better than you." "You know, I did build him,"
Tony said.
"Does that cover everything? All settled? Ready for a good night's sleep? We have a meeting with my PR staff tomorrow at 9.
Steve drew a deep breath to yell with.
"Let it go,"
Sam said to him, and Steve exhaled all at once and stalked away down the hall. Tony watched him go.
"Seriously, does that work in bed? Because that could..."
He caught Sam's eye.
"Stopping now."
"Good," Sam said, and crooked a finger. Tony warily trailed after him into the kitchen, still full of boxes and grocery bags. Sam opened the fridge, where they'd shoved aside the welcome bottle of Dom for a six-pack of Brooklyn Brewery, and got out a couple of bottles. He handed Tony one.
"You want to tell me why this is flipping you out?"
"I'm not flipping out," Tony said. "I am having a sensible, realistic, 100%...
"Okay, don't do that. Listen, I was living in a dorm room in MIT when my parents died, and I inherited $26 billion and the largest arms manufacturer in the country. And if you think you have any understanding of how bad this is going to be, you don't."
Sam nodded a little.
"How old were you?"
16, Tony said flatly.
"Okay,"
Sam said.
"You want to help us, I need you to pack that up and put it to one side. We don't want cameras in our business all the time, but we're in a pretty good place right now, and we're both grown men. We can handle a lot, and we got a place to try and get away from it now, and you did that, so thank you. But no PR for now. We're going to try it our way first. Nothing's going to keep us from doing a bunch of interviews later if we need to. Except the injuries you'll have suffered from being trampled flat by the first wave of paparazzi," Tony said.
Sam was reaching over into a big accordion file folder they'd left next to the phone on the counter and held out an envelope.
I don't like being handed things. Are you trying to pay me rent? Because the market rent for... It's a wedding invitation.
Sam said,
I know you're pretty busy. It's okay if you can't make it.
Tony stared at him.
You're inviting me to the wedding.
Yeah? Sam said, raising an eyebrow.
I didn't think it was going to be that big a surprise. You realize that the news will break approximately 3 seconds after I set foot inside the church, at the absolute latest, and almost certainly before.
Tony said,
We're not trying to keep any secrets here.
Sam said,
What people find out and what they say and do about it, that's not something we're trying to control. We're going to just live our lives, and that means inviting our friends to our wedding. That include you? Okay, fine.
Tony said, taking the invitation.
Don't say I didn't warn you.
No, Sam said.
We won't say that.
Pepper pounced on the invitation with all the starveling hunger of a lean jungle cat. Oh, a morning wedding, she said. I love morning weddings. You'll have to wear a morning suit. I need to get a dress. Maybe Balenciaga.
Yeah, sure, whatever,
Tony said, collapsing on the couch with an ice pack.
I hope you all enjoy this very beautiful delusion as long as you can before it shatters into a billion tiny pieces all around you.
Obviously, it had been too much to hope that the secret could be kept even up to the wedding. It started breaking the next morning. The Wilson clan was substantial, and they were all invited, because Steve and Sam believed in family, or some wholesome bullshit like that. One of them posted a selfie on Facebook in a fancy dress, with the caption, Getting it together for my cousin's wedding next weekend. And her college roommate asked, Lol, which one? You have 894 of them, don't you? And the cousin said, Lol, girl, the superhero. With another selfie of herself doing a victory sign in front of a framed copy of the front page shot from the Washington Post, the one of Sam and his wings in the middle of the firefight over the Potomac. Another so-called friend tweeted a link, and after that, they were off to the races. To do justice to Wilson's relations, that was the extent of the leak on their side. They all clammed completely and disapprovingly when reporters started showing up and started asking them questions. Separately, the substantial campaign contributions Tony had made to the current mayor paid off with a privately delivered marriage license made out in the tower by a dazed-looking clerk who had signed an NDA in exchange for a check deposited in an escrow account to be paid if and only if the secret didn't make it out in advance. As a result, the press had as yet failed to figure out who Sam Wilson was marrying. No thanks to the assistant at the tuxedo shop. In more pointless obstinacy, Steve and Sam had refused to let Tony have his tailors do them a pair of bespoke suits, who had posted a stealthy pic of the happy couple getting fitted together, in which Steve's expression of confusion and dismay should probably have been a dead giveaway that he was getting married. Instead, everyone had assumed he was going to be the best man, which the press loved to bits, and would keep loving to bits, probably, until the minute he was standing in front of the altar. Then they would realize they now all looked like fucking morons, and would probably turn twice as vicious in revenge. Someone at Balenciaga had told a friend about Pepper's dress, which was being delivered the day before what the press was already calling, with unwitting accuracy, the first Avengers marriage. So the word broke out on the street that she and Tony were going. The church posted a polite notice on their Facebook page 2 hours later, saying that due to unusual circumstances, on Saturday the church would only be open to congregation members and invited wedding guests with an invitation. "That's very nice, Michael," Pepper was saying on the phone. "But no, he's not interested in selling the broadcast rights. No. No, not even if you could get him $5 million. No, he doesn't need to discuss it with his fiancée. I have to go. Sorry."
"Who is that?"
Tony demanded, lifting off the ice pack that had apparently permanently migrated onto his forehead for the duration.
Did he know?
No, Tony, he did not know, Pepper said. That was the head of the PR company you have representing the Avengers, who is deeply bitter about not being able to do any of the PR you led him to believe he was going to get to do, and therefore keeps calling me with the latest offers he's gotten for Sam.
That is so not my fault,
Tony said.
I completely refuse all blame.
The loud thump out on the balcony made them both jump. Thor had just landed out of nowhere.
You know, that's just not a reasonable way to make an entrance, Tony said, opening the door. No offense. None taken,
Thor said, clapping him on the shoulder and continuing straight on to Pepper. He was wearing jeans and a t-shirt, which was even more wrong.
My Lady Pepper, you are as always a delight to the eyes.
And then he kissed her hand,
just like he was some kind of prince or something. Jesus. Thor, Pepper said, beaming. You got my message.
Message? Tony mouthed at her behind Thor's back, glaring.
Indeed I did, Thor said, and I am indebted to you for the news. There is no greater joy to wish for a friend and fellow warrior than that he find the partner of his life, and my beloved Jane and I will be glad to stand with you in place of the kin and friends whom Captain Rogers has lost, through no fault of his own, and rather by the extent of his valor. His chosen partner is a warrior of some honor and repute himself, I understand.
Tony furiously mimed, Are you kidding me? At Pepper, who continued to ignore him and smile serenely at Thor.
Oh, you have to meet Sam, Pepper said. When is Jane arriving? I have but now left her upon the streets below, as she wished to purchase a gown suitable for the occasion, Thor said. I thought it best to inquire of you, my friend, he added, turning. Tony straightened up in a hurry. What garb would be most fitting for the occasion? In Asgard I would array myself as a warrior for the exchange of vows between two such, but Jane assures me there will be no combat after the feasting.
Combat!
Tony hissed to Pepper, after he'd shoved Thor in with the still-sulking tailors, who cheered up the second they saw him.
Combat?
Which he now knows is not going to occur, Pepper said firmly. You know, now that Thor and Jane came, I'm going to go talk to Sam and Steve about having a little dinner up here tomorrow night. I think it'll make Steve feel a little better.
Better?
Tony said. An Asgardian deity is now attending his wedding. The potential for casualties has at least doubled. And since Thor dropped Jane Foster off in front of the building, the paparazzi saw it. And if they weren't literally frothing at the mouth already, they will be now.
Pepper stepped in and put her hands on his chest. Tony, she said, in that quiet way that meant he really had to pay attention to what she was saying. In case you've missed it, Steve feels like he's bringing nothing to the table but trouble.
What? Tony said. Wait, who are we? We're talking about Captain America Steve.
Yes, Captain America Steve, Pepper said, who has no family and no friends left, and a very weird and dangerous job that could maybe get Sam hurt. And every time you go in there with another rant about how the press are going to make their read Sam's life a misery forever, he feels worse, because he thinks it's his fault.
Ah, Tony said.
So I think it would be really nice if we could fill a few pews on his side of the church, Pepper said.
Well, Thor can fill one up by himself, so good going there,
Tony said, after a moment. Pepper tilted a smile at him. Yes, I thought so.
Tony had spent the last 6 months alternately cajoling, begging, pleading, demanding, harassing, coaxing, and otherwise failing to get the gang back together under his roof. Apparently, all he'd needed to do was throw a wedding. Natasha showed up the next morning with a suit of her own. She was going to be Roger's best man, and Barton in tow. Maria Hill made it by the afternoon, and shortly after they all sat down to possibly the weirdest dinner party ever thrown, the door swung open, and Fury came in. He had a suit bag over one arm, which he tossed over a side table. He took one of the handful of empty chairs at the table, picked up the wine glass Thor had already poured for him, and said, I'm only doing this once, and I'm getting it over with now. So savor it. Congratulations. And it's a good thing you two are getting married, because nobody else deserves to get saddled with either one of you damn lunatics.
Steve actually laughed out loud, and he and Wilson both got up to shake hands with Fury. Thor broke out the Asgardian drinking songs after dinner, taught them the lyrics, and they all ended up standing and belting them out together on the balcony. Tony felt considerably mellowed by the large quantity of wine he'd drunk, as the party quieted down finally, breaking out the cohibas and brandy. He wandered over to where Steve was looking out over the city, blinking into the wind that was ruffling his hair. Sam was talking with Barton on the other side of the building.
Cigar?
Tony said.
Or is it don't drink, don't smoke?
Steve hesitated and looked at it. I've never tried, actually, he said, and accepted one. He promptly inhaled too deep and started coughing. Tony whacked him on the back a few times companionably.
So, it occurs to me,
he said, after Steve managed to right himself and take a more cautious drag.
I've never actually said this, so congratulations.
Thanks, Steve said, and cleared his throat.
For all of this, actually,
he added, waving a hand around. Tony shrugged.
This was all Pepper. Nearly all Pepper. Mostly Pepper. The point I'm trying to make is,
he said abruptly,
I know a little bit of what it's like to be the, shall we say, less functional human being in a relationship.
Steve looked at him, a little startled. Tony added,
which I hasten to say is a reasonably high bar in your case. Seriously, he's so sane there's probably something wrong with him.
Steve huffed a laugh.
Yeah,
He dropped his gaze, smiling a little.
I got lucky,
he said softly.
Precisely,
Tony said,
which is why my advice to you is this. Don't try to deserve it. You can't deserve it. You just get lucky.
Steve looked even more startled, in a vaguely unflattering way, like he hadn't expected Tony to have useful advice to offer.
You know, Rogers, the problem with you is you don't appreciate me enough,
Tony said.
Oh, is that my problem?
Steve said,
I guess I'll have to work on that,
grinning at him suddenly. And, okay, Tony could see why possibly someone would consider marrying the guy, aside from all the nobility and heroism, which probably got boring really fast. The day of the wedding was beautiful, clear, sunny and not too hot, perfect weather for long-range photography. Tony scowled out the window as he tied his tie, then went downstairs and barged in on the Rogers-Wilson household. Steve was standing in the living room, making his cheap suit look better than it deserved to, and muttering to himself over a printed card with his lines on it, wearing a look of mild terror completely inadequate to the experience he was about to undergo.
"Where's your soon-to-be better half?"
Tony said.
"He spent the night at his mother's."
Steve said, "We thought it would be nice to meet at the church." Then he looked up and frowned towards the door, and then back at Tony.
"What?"
Tony said.
"The security detail is meeting you here."
"We don't need a security detail," Steve said.
"Oh, how wrong you would be about that,"
Tony said.
"Jarvis?"
There was no answer, and he swore under his breath and pulled out his phone.
"Jarvis, turn the mics back on in here and send a security detail to wherever Sam Wilson's mother lives."
"Cancel that," Natasha said, coming in from the foyer. She was razor sharp in a beautiful suit.
"See, Natasha doesn't think we need a security detail,"
Steve said, glaring. Then he double-taked at her and frowned towards the front door again, starting to open his mouth.
"No, I do think you need a security detail, so I've already arranged one for Sam," she said.
"Barton's on it. Are you ready? Let me see the tie."
"How did you get in?"
Steve was still trying to ask, as Natasha nudged him facing her and did a critical pass over the suit, touching the pocket square with a frown, adjusting it half a millimeter up. Tony approved.
"You should have let Stark get your suits," she said,
"but you'll do."
"To be fair, no one is going to be paying attention to their suits anyway," Tony said. "The tie, maybe a little to the left."
Natasha nodded.
"I'm going to put a bolt on,"
Steve said loudly.
"You think I can't get through a bolt?"
Natasha said absently, tweaking.
"I could just make like Thor and land on the balcony,"
Tony said.
"Why did I ever move in here?"
Steve said.
"I'm going to take a wild guess and say that Sam told you to,"
Tony said. Then he remembered what Pepper had said and patted Steve's shoulder.
"Just consider us the horrible relatives no one wants to have at their wedding but has to invite anyway."
Because Pepper was a genius, that worked beautifully. Rogers actually got quiet and somewhat suspiciously shiny-eyed, and Natasha even shot Tony a sidelong look that was the closest thing to impress that he'd ever gotten out of her.
"Mr. Stark," Jarvis said, "Miss Potts is looking for you."
The doorbell rang.
"Well, at least now I know the bell works," Steve said.
Pepper poked her head in.
"Still not sure about the doorknob."
"Steve, I'm so sorry," Pepper said. "I didn't mean to let him off a leash today. Also, we need to leave now if we're not going to be late."
"Okay," Tony said. "Let's all just take a moment, have a few deep breaths, find your center." "Tony, I've walked into bases full of soldiers armed with machine guns,"
Steve said.
"Let's go." "The significant difference is that you are allowed to shoot back," Tony said.
Tony really hated being right sometimes. The look on Roger's face when they pulled up to the church obviated the need for any version of "I told you so." The cameras were 20 deep, with 3 helicopters going overhead. Even the tourists had been crowded back. They were packing the sidewalks 3 blocks in every direction. The explosion of noise when the limo door was opened made Steve unconsciously flatten himself back against the seats. Tony clapped him on the shoulder.
3 rules. Smile, keep moving, don't respond to anything. You'll do fine. Also, consider this your wedding present.
He told Natasha,
"Give me 2 minutes, then get him into the church,"
and climbed out of the limo into the roar, held up his hands, grinning with all his teeth, "Come and get me, assholes," turned back to give Pepper his hand out of the limo, and drew her with him to the edge of the walkway the security team he'd sent in 2 nights before had managed to cordon off. The press all immediately started trying to converge on them, yelling questions. Did he know the bride? Was the secrecy an effort to protect her from attacks?
"Nope, just from you guys,"
Tony said, smiling. Ha ha, hilarious.
What's that guy's name in the third row? The one from CNN.
He murmured to Pepper. Michael. She murmured back. He hates being called Mike.
Hey, Mike! Tony called. How did you get roped into this one?
There was nothing reporters loved more than being called out by name. Tony tossed them a couple more bones, and by the time Steve and Natasha climbed out of the limo, Steve looking utterly appalled, none of them could bear to tear themselves away from the chance that Tony might talk to them next. He gave it a few more minutes, then waved a hand and escorted Pepper inside. The church was full, and at least a few of the congregants, sitting with faintly guilty expressions and avoiding eye contact, were probably ringers, planning to sell videos to the press, if they hadn't been recruited already. But for the most part, Wilson really had that many relatives and friends. Everyone was just starting to sit down. Tony took Pepper up front, and Natasha introduced them to the Wilson clan, several matriarchs wearing fantastic hats, and a wide array of extremely attractive cousins, and Sam's best man, identified by Jarvis as another of the guys from the XO7 project. He had a silver star and a prosthetic leg. Tony pulled some statistics while waiting for the ceremony to get underway. It turned out the program had been scrapped, because every operator who'd gone out on more than 100 missions had taken a spill bad enough to wash out. Not technical failure, just human error. Wilson was the sole exception, which put pay to Tony's half-formed ideas of putting together an aerial support squadron, but on the brighter side meant he didn't have to bother with the headaches of figuring out how to get the per-unit costs down, since he'd only have to build one. The church went abruptly quiet, and as they all stood up, Pepper reached over and silently took his phone away, which was fair enough, actually. Tony sat up. Sam and Steve had both come out with the minister and were making their way to the front of the room. They stood up at the altar together, and Pepper made a small hitching sniff as they all sat down again at the minister's word. They haven't even started yet, Tony hissed. They look so happy, she whispered back. In Tony's personal opinion, Sam looked as deadly serious as a man facing a firing squad, while Steve had evidently gone through mortal terror and come out the other side into the perfect calm of knowing the worst was happening and there was nothing he could do about it now. They were exchanging a few quiet words with the minister, and there was some rustling and whispering starting in the back rows, the ones full of ringers, as they realized what was going on.
"Dearly beloved," the minister began in a rolling voice, "we have come together in the presence of God to witness and bless the joining together of Stephen Grant Rogers and Samuel Thomas Wilson in holy matrimony."
The paparazzi had set up dozens of directional mics outside, expertly aimed at every available crack and crevice that could get them audio from inside the church. Tony cocked an ear to listen for it, and he wasn't disappointed. The slowly growing oceanic roar of 1,000 reporters, realizing that the story they were here to cover was at least 1,000 times bigger than they thought it was, that it was all happening not 100 yards away from their live cameras, and that they couldn't get at it. There was one fairly odd moment in the "any just cause to bar the marriage" bit, where Sam turned and looked straight over all their heads at the back of the church, to the point Tony turned to see what he was looking at. There was nothing but the shadowy rafters, as far as he could tell, but when he looked back, Sam was smiling at Steve, and Steve had his head ducked and looked weirdly happy, or possibly just relieved. Maybe they were getting the okay straight from God, or Steve's dead mother, who knew. Anyway, in Tony's private opinion, his own wholehearted approval was worth more than what either of those had to say about it, since he could actually back it up in the real world. Other than that, the ceremony was nice, meaningful, lots of prayers, etc., the requisite number of crying family members. Tony could admit that when Steve's voice broke on "to have and to hold," and he had to stop and grip Sam's hand, it made even him feel a little verklempt. Fortunately, he got better quickly, which was just as well, because by the time the ceremony was over, Happy was coming to find him, grim-faced, to say he couldn't even get them across the street to the reception hall.
"I think we're okay for the moment as long as we sit tight. But, Tony, we're not getting out of this building without freaking riot police," he said. "Another 60 news vans have shown up, and about half of New York came with them." "How many channels are we on?" Tony asked fatalistically. "All of them,"
Happy said.
"Well, I think Nickelodeon's still showing SpongeBob, but that's about it."
"Pardon me," Thor said, leaning over the back of the pew behind them.
"Do you mean to say we have been besieged? If need be, say the word, and I will clear a path through our foes."
I think we're just going to hang out in here for a while and let the NYPD handle this one, big guy, Tony said.
That plan, however, was only as solid as the church. There were people literally crawling over the building, and it turned out there was an iron bar missing over one of the basement windows, and the one next to it was loose. By the time the security team realized they'd sprung a leak, more than 100 people had squirmed in, armed with smartphones and 2 television cameras.
"What do you think?" Barton said to Natasha. "Can I just start shooting them?"
He was casting a professional eye over the neatly lined-up row of celebrity hunters standing on the front pew videotaping. More of them were crowding in close, even shoving their way past the guests, and Steve looked increasingly miserable. He was trying to keep his body between Sam and the cameras, like he could turn himself into a wall, and Sam had a hand around his back and was talking to him, low, telling him it was okay. Something crazy had to happen at a wedding, or it didn't count. Even barring a sudden shootout, the wedding was about to count in a big way. Some of Wilson's family had started losing their tempers and were shoving back, a couple of them organizing a human chain to hold off the media. One deeply unfortunate guy had also just made the mistake of knocking over Jane Foster, who was already saying, "No, Thor, wait!" "No, you may not shoot them," Natasha said to Barton, absently. She was studying building blueprints on her phone. Then, suddenly, she swore in Russian, jerked her head straight up, and looked into the rafters. "No, don't you even—" She stopped, head whipping back around, as one of the videotapers suddenly vanished out of the row, flying over backwards. He hit the floor with a thump, followed by a faint moaning, barely audible over the general noise. The others didn't even register the disappearance immediately. Tony stared in fascination as 2 more of them followed suit. It was like watching someone shooting ducks in a gallery. Pepper was staring in horror. "Oh my God, is someone... are they dead?" "Plastic bullets," Natasha snarled, and was gone, already jumping from pew to pew over the crowd and heading for the back wall, where something was falling from the ceiling. A silencer, Tony recognized, and the next shot was absolutely loud enough to make the rest of the ducks wake up and realize they were next in line. Steve's wide-eyed look of horror went straight up to the ceiling, too, so clearly the Phantom of the Opera was not an unexpected guest. Sam covered his face with a hand and just shook his head. People were starting to scream and run. To add to the excitement, Thor had just picked up a pew, dumped the reporter on it, and shot him down it like a slide into a gaggle of 6 more. He then proceeded to bellow out, "All those who have intruded upon this ceremony uninvited shall at once depart, or face my wrath for your shameful discourtesy." He punctuated that by holding up the hammer and summoning a bolt of lightning that blew out all the windows. Tony mentally threw another 100 grand into the cleanup budget and put him into full armor, cape included. All those who had intruded upon the ceremony uninvited immediately made it a priority to depart, including straight out the front doors. The security team had been bracing them against the outside, but the sudden frenzied mob trying to escape from inside overran them, and the doors got opened into the face of the much larger frenzied mob of thousands in the street.
"This isn't great," Tony said. "Jarvis, Mark 46, now," he yelled,
and the components of the suit he'd prudently left stashed in the trunk of the limo came flying in through the, now wide open, windows and doors.
"Sam, I'm so sorry," Steve was saying, his voice breaking, and then Sam said, "Okay, man, you're asking for it,"
and grabbed him and kissed him. Even in the midst of the chaos, an explosion of flashbulbs went off. Steve wobbled back after a good, long, healthy kiss, looking dazed. Apparently Sam had it going on, and Sam poked him in the chest.
"We're married and I can't get out of it anymore, so stop panicking and get this under control. I don't want my mom getting crushed."
Steve stood there, blinked a couple of times, then said determinedly,
"Right,"
looked around the room and jumped up onto a bench himself and started shouting orders. Following Cap's plan, they managed to use the open front door as a safety valve to draw people towards the front of the church so the security could clear a route out the back. The wedding guests all got safely out with directions to hop the subway to the tower, where Pepper, evacuated by Thor Airlines, along with the oldest and youngest members of the wedding party, was helping them organize a relocated reception. Unfortunately, the guests of honor were still stuck on crowd control.
"Okay,"
Steve said to Tony, as they held a pew together against the best efforts of about 200 people to start yet another stampede and get themselves killed.
"I admit it, I should have listened to you." "You can't imagine how incredibly fulfilling that is to hear," Tony said, braced against the floor, repulsors whining.
In fact, it's possible that you're already cheating on your brand new husband just by saying that to me. I might have to have that turned into my personal ringtone, possibly emblazoned on a coat of arms.
I take it back, Steve said.
Too late,
Tony said.
I'll treasure it for oops ever.
The oops was him skidding off the edge of the dais and tumbling down the stairs. Steve was about to go over too, when a sharp thwack sounded from above, and a grappling hook wrapped around the other end of the pew and hauled it back, long enough for Tony to pick himself up and get back into position. He still didn't get a glimpse of the mystery guest, even doing as much of a sweep of the rafters as he could manage under the circumstances.
Seriously, who's the fairy godmother of destruction?
It's a long story, Steve said. The cavalry finally arrived, namely, Rhodey, leading about 5 dozen National Guardsmen the governor had loaned him on an emergency basis. Rhodey landed just outside the church, gave Tony a look that even through the mask Tony had no problem reading as deeply unamused.
Not my fault at all this time,
Tony protested, and got the crowd moving away in orderly fashion, even while he packed off the press. Afterwards they gathered on the steps and surveyed the destruction. It wasn't pretty. The church doors were going to need replacing, as were all the pews. The street was littered with broken equipment, and one news van had been completely overturned and was lying in the middle of the street still smoking.
"We're going to need a crane to get that out of here,"
Rhodey said.
"Permit me,"
Thor said politely, and picked up the van and set it back on its wheels.
"Or not,"
Rhodey said. He looked at Tony.
"Seriously, not my fault,"
Tony said.
"Captain America even said he should have listened to me."
Sam and Steve were doing some sort of excessively adorable newlywed thing, and had locked in together as soon as they got into sufficient proximity, arms around each other's waists and heads leaned in. Sam lifted his and looked at Steve.
"Dude, you didn't really tell him that, did you?"
Steve groaned.
"It was a moment of weakness."
"I'm sorry for this, Colonel," he added tiredly.
"For throwing more gasoline on the bonfire of Tony's ego? No forgiveness,"
Rhodey said.
"As for the rest of this, you all need to do me a favor. The next time any of you want to get married, elope to Tahiti. Congratulations, by the way. Come back to the tower with us,"
Tony said.
"Have a glass of champagne." "Yeah, I know how that ends,"
Rhodey said.
"No, man, I'm supposed to be in D.C. right now, except for how you started a riot in northern Manhattan and they needed me to fish out your sorry ass before you got trampled." "And again, not my fault,"
Tony said.
"Come on, one drink." "We'd be glad if you could stop in, Colonel,"
Sam said, grinning.
"Half my cousins have crushes on you." "And they're all hot,"
Tony added. Sam and Steve both immediately turned laser-sharp focus on him.
"Just speaking on a purely aesthetic basis,"
he tacked on hastily. Tony threw a great party, if he did say so himself. The reception was already going strong by the time they arrived at the tower, and it hadn't flagged at all by the time they all got cleaned up and actually managed to put in an appearance. Sam and Steve had been forced to ditch their wrecked suits and had changed into their dress uniforms instead, which didn't hurt any to look at. The room burst into applause when they walked in. Tony had magnanimously slipped in through a side entrance so as not to cause a distraction. A few news helicopters were still hovering in the distance, but Pepper had opaqued the windows, and after a while they gave up. The party kept going through dinner before people started flagging and slipping away, including the happy couple, who sneaked out not long after the cake got cut. Tony was sitting with Sam's mother at the time, and Steve and Sam came over to say good night.
Steve said, "It's late, and if it's okay, that is, we..."
Sam patted Steve on the back.
"Quit while you're ahead."
He leaned down to give his mom a kiss.
"You okay getting home? Maybe you should get a hotel for a couple of nights, let this mess die down." "A couple of weeks, actually,"
Tony said.
Ah.
He pointed when Steve was about to protest.
"As you said, and I quote..."
"Please don't," Steve said.
"No worries, baby,"
Steve's mother said.
"Me and your grandma are going to take a little vacation. Go down to your Uncle Mark's place for a few weeks. Come here, honey. Your mama can't be here today, so I'm standing in."
Steve blushed and bent down for his own hug and kiss.
"You boys take care of each other."
The two of them slipped out, holding hands. Steve looked ridiculously excited. Tony offered her a champagne glass.
"Mission accomplished?"
he said. She gave him a skeptical eyebrow that implied she doubted the critical role he had played in the successful conclusion to the day's events, but clinked her glass against his anyway.
"Much as we can do anyway,"
she said.
"They'll have to take it on their own from here."
Steve concentrated on getting his uniform put away properly. He was almost painfully conscious of Sam moving around the room behind his back, the soft rustling noises. He'd spent the whole last week irritated at the damn apartment, at Tony, at himself. More ways he'd turned Sam's life inside out and upside down. The night before they'd moved, he'd even forced himself to say something, to give Sam an out, no matter how unbearable it would have been. Sam had sat him down on the couch in the middle of all their boxes and said, "Last time I'm going to say this. If I wasn't ready for my life to get a whole lot more complicated, I would have let you walk away from me on the mall 6 months ago." Somehow, Steve hadn't really been able to hear it then, but there was no way Sam would take a vow before God and his family and the whole world that he didn't mean to keep. Sam had stood up and taken him as his husband, and that meant Sam was in for it now, no matter what. Realizing that had been such a goddamned relief, even in the middle of a screaming mob and complete disaster all around them. The screaming mob hadn't even seemed all that important afterwards, just a problem to be dealt with, like any other. Now Steve could actually be grateful for all of this, a safe retreat, the security that had protected his new family, the people who'd stood up with him. And, what the hell, he'd do a few interviews if that made anybody's life easier. He'd spent 3 months of World War II pretty much high-kicking in a chorus line. He could live with talking to a reporter. And right now, he was especially grateful for the ridiculously large bed behind his back. He'd groused even about that, when they'd first slept on it, and Sam had just snorted and spread-eagled himself over it and told him to go sleep on the couch if he didn't like it. Well, now Steve could admit he did like it. He liked it a whole lot. He had hung all his clothes up. He skimmed off his shorts and turned around and swallowed, because Sam had stretched himself out on the bed, one arm behind him pillowing his head, and watching him finish stripping with lazy appreciation, smiling.
"So," he said, his voice a low warm rumble, "how does it feel to be a married man?"
Steve had to clear his throat.
"Oh, it's all right, I guess. I don't know. I was expecting a little more, maybe."
He darted a look at Sam from under his eyelashes.
"Get your ass in this bed,"
Sam said sternly, and Steve laughed helplessly and went, as fast as he could, because there was nothing as good as putting himself in Sam's hands, knowing they would hold him up.
"Expectin' more,"
Sam was muttering in mock indignation, sliding his hand into Steve's hair, tugging him down for soft, deep, sweet kisses. Steve wrapped a leg up over Sam's hip. Sam stroked a broad hand over Steve's thigh, rubbing slow circles over it up to the curve of his ass.
"Did you have some plans for how tonight might go, maybe?"
he said, deep and amused.
"Well, not if you're too tired or anything,"
Steve said, breathlessly. The last few weeks, selling the house, Sam's finals, moving, his own messed-up head, it hadn't left a lot of space for making love. They had jerked off together a few times, but, Christ, he wanted to be taken right now. He wanted to feel it deep in his body, Sam's claim on him. He laid down some hopeful little kissing bites along Sam's jaw.
"Oh, you're asking for it, aren't you?"
Sam said, pushing Steve over onto his back, settling down between his legs.
Steve groaned and arched up into him. "Yes," he said. "Yes, Sam,
Too distracted to keep up anything like banter, Sam's cock sliding hot against his, the weight of his body resting on him, and Steve gave up talking at all and just groped blindly for the lube, one hand gripping Sam's head, holding him for kisses, grinding shamelessly up against him. Tony did a final circuit round the room and slipped up behind Pepper, who was talking with Natasha out on the balcony.
"So, I thought I'd go check out our news coverage before bed,"
he murmured with a quick nuzzle to her cheek. "Well, that sounds delightful, but I think I'll stay here and have some more champagne myself," Pepper said, smiling around at him. He kissed her.
"See you in a bit."
He stole a half-full bottle of champagne, snagged one of the crystal Waterford bowls full of salted nuts, and tugged open his tie with one finger as he strolled whistling down the stairway to the tower's command center. He frowned slightly as he got closer. There were flickering lights coming down the hallway. The kids had probably found the room.
"So while I appreciate Call of Duty as much as the next guy,"
he started coming in, and stopped short. A complete stranger, dressed all in black, was sitting in one of the viewing chairs, boots up on the console. Also, interestingly, he seemed to have a metal arm. He shot Tony a cold, blank stare out from under long, messy, dark hair. There was a large sniper rifle leaned against the console next to his boots. All 20 of them were lit up with different angles going on the same extremely vivid scene currently taking place in Sam and Steve's bedroom.
"Well," Tony said after a moment, "either you're a very strangely dressed entrepreneur trying to make your name in online porn, or I'm not really sure what you're doing here."
Tall, dark, and metal scowled at him.
"Keeping an eye on things."
"Uh-huh," Tony said. He took the seat next to him and put the bowl of nuts on the table between them.
"Do you have a name, or should I go with Dread Pirate Roberts?"
After a little more scowling, the guy muttered,
"Bucky."
Tony nodded. "Right. Captain America's dead best friend from World War II. That seemed reasonable, and roughly in line with the rest of the day." He put his own feet up and waved at the screens.
"Is this purely for entertainment value, or are there significant concerns?"
"You know how many people Rogers has slept with?" Bucky demanded.
"I hadn't previously given it an enormous amount of thought, but now you mention it, I'm guessing the number is low," Tony said.
"One," Bucky said.
"Ouch," Tony said. "Including..."
He jerked a chin toward Sam. Bucky nodded significantly.
"Say no more."
"I believe I should note for the record that I'm quite certain this violates Ms. Potts' orders regarding respect for privacy," Jarvis interjected pissily.
"Hey, they're the ones who gave him the key,"
Tony said. He took a handful of nuts and munched them while considering the screens. The view from camera 14, side on, where Steve's leg was hooked over Sam's shoulder, and you could see Sam's cock sliding thoroughly in and out of him, was particularly inspiring, to tell the truth, especially since camera 13 was directly above the bed, giving a clear view of Steve's blissed-out jolt every time Sam brought the goods home. His eyes were drifting shut between each thrust, and then each stroke made him come wide awake, almost shocked, and open slack-mouthed, gasping. His hips were moving in tiny jerks to meet Sam's thrusts, and his whole body shining all over with sweat, spectacularly golden. Abruptly he said, "Oh, oh, God," loudly.
"Yeah, baby,"
Sam murmured, husky and panting.
"You getting there? You know I've got you."
"Yes," Steve said.
"Yes, Sam, I know. I know,"
gasping, almost a sob, his face nakedly joyful. Tony had to actually look away, clearing his throat.
"I'd have to say he's done okay for himself, speaking from considerably wider experience."
"Yeah?" Bucky said, shooting him a frowning, intent look. He didn't seem at all bothered by intruding on the moment.
"Yes,"
Tony said positively.
"Wouldn't you agree?" "I wanted to be sure,"
Bucky said.
"Thanks,"
he added with rough sincerity, as though he appreciated Tony's expert opinion. He looked back at the screens.
"I guess we should turn it off."
"Any time you like," Jarvis said pointedly. On the screen, Sam and Steve were moving seamlessly into round two. Tony absently reached for more nuts, just as Bucky did, negotiating the bowl around the metal fingers. They watched together for a few more moments. Not his usual thing, but that didn't mean he couldn't admire a world-class performance when he saw it.
"If you're both quite finished," Jarvis said, even more pointedly. All right, let's get some CNN going in here,"
Tony said. All the screens immediately switched over, and that was a whole new source of pleasure, specifically sweet, delicious schadenfreude. Three reporters, one bandaged.
"I shot that one,"
Bucky said, sounding pleased, and their footage was so bad they kept cutting to still photographs of Sam and Steve looking hot and heroic, trying to sell the story with swooshing graphics and dramatic voiceovers. Wolf Blitzer ponderously announced they'd be right back with more on The Marriage of the Century. Bucky snorted and held out his hand for Tony's bottle of champagne and swigged from it.
"More like the miracle of the century. I remember when that punk couldn't get himself laid in all of Brooklyn." "Can I interest you in telling that story on Good Morning America?"
Tony said.
"I like the way you handle the press."
The end.